This is Audible.
The Saratoga Campaign. The History and Legacy of the Revolutionary War's Turning Point. Written by Charles River Editors. Narrated by Scott Clem. Introduction. The American Revolution is replete with seminal moments that every American learns in school, from the shot heard round the world to the Declaration of Independence. But the events that led up to the fighting at Lexington and Concord were born out of 10 years of division between the British and their American colonies over everything from colonial representation in government to taxation, the nature of searches, and the quartering of British regulars in private houses. From 1764 to 1775, a chain of events that included lightning rods like the Townshend Acts led to bloodshed in the form of the Boston Massacre, while the Boston Tea Party became a symbol of nonviolent protest. The political and military nature of the Revolutionary War was just as full of intrigue. While disorganized militias fought the battles of Lexington and Concord, George Washington would lead the Continental Army in the field, while men like Thomas Jefferson drafted the Declaration of Independence in Philadelphia, and Benjamin Franklin negotiated overseas in France. French forces would play a crucial role at the end of the war, and the Treaty of Paris would conclude the Revolution with one last great surprise. On October 7, 1777, Benedict Arnold rode out against orders and led an American assault against British forces, led by General John Burgoyne in one of the climactic battles and ultimate turning point of the war at Saratoga. Near the end of the most important American victory of the Revolution, Arnold's leg was shattered by a volley that also hit his horse, which fell on the leg as well. Arnold would later remark that he wished the shot had hit him in the chest, and if it had, Benedict Arnold would be remembered as one of America's greatest war heroes, second only to George Washington among the generals of the Revolution. In fact, when Arnold was injured at the height of his success in October 1777, he had been the most successful leader of American forces during the war. Arnold had been instrumental in the seizure of Fort Ticonderoga in 1775. He constructed the first makeshift American Navy to defend Lake Champlain and delay British campaigning in 1776, and he was the principal leader at Saratoga in 1777. Even his unsuccessful campaign to Quebec in the winter of 1775 is remembered primarily for the amazing logistical feats undertaken by Arnold and his men to even reach the targets. All of that was overshadowed by Arnold's treacherous plot to turn over West Point to the British in 1780. But his controversial actions at Saratoga and the results may very well have saved the cause he subsequently betrayed. At the end of 1776, the American war effort was on the verge of collapse, and despite Washington's success at Trenton, the British were confident that they could quell the rebellion in 1777. That winter, the British planned a complicated campaign in which British armies from Canada and New York would strike out across New England and link up, with the goal of cutting off the northern colonies. Indeed, 1777 did prove to be the pivotal year of the war, but not in the way the British intended. The British planned a three-pronged sweep through the northern colonies that would eventually end with the linking of three different forces. The design of the plan called for the capture of Philadelphia, as well as the colony of New York, and it aimed at all but slicing the rebellious colonies in two. The main thrust of the campaign was John Burgoyne's army of nearly 8,000 men, which started out from Quebec and began making its way south through New York. From the beginning, however, Burgoyne was not on the same page as William Howe. Burgoyne had concocted the campaign strategy and received approval from an intermediary. But Howe had informed that same intermediary that he could not meet up with Burgoyne in New York because he calculated he would be busy late into the year taking Philadelphia. It's unclear whether Burgoyne was ever informed of Howe's response, but unbeknownst to each other, the two commanders were not on the same page. By July, Burgoyne had taken Fort Ticonderoga in New York. But as he tried to get a bearing on the coordinated strategy, the Americans shot another hole into the grand campaign at Port Stanwitz. The British and their Native American allies had inflicted some serious damage on militiamen near Port Stanwitz, but Arnold led an 800-man contingent to the outskirts of the fort and began to lay siege. Realizing that he would not win an open battle, Arnold resorted to subterfuge and succeeded in fooling the British allied Native Americans that he had a much larger force. When the British were left without their allies, Lieutenant Colonel Barry St. Leger decided to head back toward Quebec. His men would never link up with Burgoyne's as planned. At the end of August, Burgoyne learned that St. Leger would not be linking up with him, and that he could not expect help from Howe near New York City or Philadelphia. Nevertheless, while worried about where he would camp his army for the winter, Burgoyne decided to keep advancing in September. Thus, instead of heading back to Ticonderoga, Burgoyne made Albany his target for winter camping, and he ordered his army forward until they were just a few miles north of Saratoga by mid-September. Opposing the British were nearly 10,000 Americans, led by General Horatio Gates, who had taken over for Philip Schuyler. With the advice of renowned Polish engineer Thaddeus Kosciuszko, Gates anchored his army's line from the Hudson River to bluffs known as Bemis Heights. Gates assumed direct command of the army's right wing, and he put Arnold in command of the left wing, which was stationed on Bemis Heights. Though the two had gotten along earlier in the war, and Gates had been one of Arnold's strongest allies, he was apparently rubbed the wrong way when Arnold chose Schuyler allies for his staff. Gates despised Schuyler, and this led to animosity between Gates and Arnold, and this led to animosity between Gates and Arnold as well, due to both generals' obstinate personalities. During the First Battle of Saratoga, fought on September 19th, Burgoyne's army moved to flank Arnold, who had anticipated an attack on his wing, and had asked Gates to allow him to position his troops on Freeman's Farm to block a potential flank attack. Gates, however, anticipated a frontal assault, and thus only allowed Arnold to send a small contingent of Daniel Morgan's riflemen and other light infantry to reconnoiter in that vicinity. As it turned out, that reconnaissance came into contact with Burgoyne's flank, starting the Battle of Freeman's Farm. Although the British won a tactical victory, the Americans inflicted nearly 600 casualties, about 10% of Burgoyne's effective fighting force. Understandably, Arnold was miffed that the results took place because his advice had been ignored, and it boiled over into an all-out feud with Gates, who conspicuously refused to mention Arnold at all in the official account of the battle. At the same time, Gates removed Morgan's company from Arnold's command, bringing about a vocal shouting match between Gates and Arnold that resulted in Gates sidelining Arnold and telling him he was being replaced in command of that wing. After the argument, Arnold began preparing to formally request a transfer to George Washington's command, while Gates continued to humiliate Arnold at the camp. It's still unclear why Arnold continued to stay with Gates' army, but it proved to be one of the most fortuitous decisions of the American Revolution. Unbeknownst to the Americans at the time, Burgoyne was in contact with British General Sir Henry Clinton over whether Clinton could move diversionary forces in time to assist Burgoyne. Burgoyne went so far as to explain to Clinton that he would be forced to retreat by early October without reinforcements. As fate would have it, Clinton would actually begin moving forces that way and take some ports in the vicinity in early October. But his messengers announcing that to Burgoyne were captured. Burgoyne wouldn't learn about Clinton's movements until after the Battle of Bemis Heights. In early October, the demoted Arnold got into one more argument with Gates after proposing an advance against the British. By this time, Gates had taken command of the left wing and promptly informed Arnold, "You have no business here." At the same time, when General Lincoln proposed similar advice, Gates took it and followed it. With a plan to attack both British flanks, the Battle of Bemis Heights started with the American advance on the left coming into contact with the British. the Americans began making progress on both sides of the British line, and British General Simon Fraser was mortally wounded on their right flank, helping the American cause. As gunfire could be heard back at camp, Arnold only got more agitated at his situation. Unable to stand being sidelined anymore, Arnold took off toward the right, where Enoch Poor's column was attempting to flank the British left. With this obvious defiance of orders and complete insubordination, Gates sent an aide after Arnold to bring him back to camp. Thankfully, that aide, Major Armstrong, was unable to do so. To every soldier's surprise, General Arnold was soon spotted at the front leading the attack on a British redoubt. Arnold was so worked up that some believed he had been drinking. The British had been able to hold the redoubt with such spirit that Burgoyne wrote after the battle, "A more determined perseverance than they showed is not in any officer's experience." However, it would be Arnold who persevered, and he led another charge through a gap between two British redoubts, allowing American troops to threaten the rear of British General Bryman's men in the redoubt. Showing absolutely no concern for his well-being, Arnold rode his horse up and down the line between the Americans and British. During the attack, Bryman was killed and the Americans captured the redoubt. But near the end of the fighting, one of the final volleys hit Arnold in his leg and his horse, who fell under the same leg and broke it. At that point, Arnold was finally brought back on a litter by Major Armstrong to camp. By the time the decisive American victory was finished, Burgoyne had lost nearly 20% of his effective fighting during the battles at Saratoga, and after a few days, his trapped army surrendered to the Americans. In December 1776, Benjamin Franklin was sent by Congress to France to attempt to secure a critically needed alliance. Franklin was an ideal choice for enlightened France, which revered Franklin for his scientific accomplishments and his known reputation as a brilliant man. Franklin had also been a diplomat before the Revolution, spending several years in London on behalf of the colonies. However, the French refused to provide more than arms and money throughout 1777, until they learned in December 1777 about Saratoga and Burgoyne's surrender. With that news, French King Louis XVI entered into a formal military alliance with the United States, and in February 1778, France joined the war. Naturally, the accolades for Saratoga went to Gates as commanding general, while the grievously wounded Arnold would be recommissioned Major General Arnold, with his proper relative rank restored. Even still, Gates failed to credit Arnold for the success at Saratoga, and his actions also came at an incredible cost. His leg was so shattered that doctors wanted to amputate it, failing to do so only at the threat of physical violence by Arnold himself. By setting the leg, it would remain 2 inches shorter than Arnold's other leg for the rest of his life. Arnold would be out of service for nearly half a year, and he would never truly be physically fit again. In that way, the very battle that may have won the Revolution also set in process a chain of events that led to the most notorious act of betrayal in American history. The Saratoga Campaign, the history and legacy of the Revolutionary War's turning point, examines one of the Revolution's most important campaigns and the massive ramifications of the British surrender. In this audiobook, you will learn about Saratoga like never before. Planning the campaign. George Washington is perhaps the most famous American in history and is viewed as his country's greatest revolutionary hero. But he and his Continental Army had a terrible year after the British evacuated Boston in March 1776. After the siege of Boston, Washington suspected that the British evacuated by sea to New York City, the next logical target in an attempt to end a colonial resurrection. He thus rushed his army south to defend the city. Washington guessed correctly, but it would be to no avail. Unlike Boston, New York City's terrain featured few defensible positions. The city lacked a high point from which to launch a siege on an occupation, as the peninsula of Boston was fortunate to have. Moreover, Washington wasn't sure defending the city was necessary. Hoping that an expedition launched toward Quebec like the one Benedict Arnold had led in late 1775 would keep the British away from New York. But Congress thought otherwise and demanded that Washington defend New York. Washington thus did what he was told, to his demise. In the summer of 1776, the British conducted the largest amphibious expedition in North America's history at the time, landing over 20,000 troops on Long Island. British General William Howe, who had led the British at Bunker Hill and would later become commander-in-chief of the armies in North America, easily captured Staten Island, which Washington was incapable of defending without a proper navy. Washington's army attempted to fight, but Washington was badly outmaneuvered, and his army was nearly cut off from escape, and its withdrawal across New York City was enormously disorderly, with many of Washington's troops so scared that they deserted. Others were sick, with dysentery and smallpox plaguing the Continental Army in New York. In what was arguably the worst defeat of the Revolution, Washington was ashamed. He also felt betrayed by both his troops and Congress. To escape from New York, Washington led a tactical retreat across the East River and off Long Island in the middle of the night without British knowledge. This retreat prevented the annihilation of the Colonial Army in New York, but with Washington being pushed west across New Jersey and into Pennsylvania, Congress was forced to flee Philadelphia. And with this string of crucial British successes in 1776, the Revolution was on the brink of failure. The Continental Army, now in Pennsylvania, had lost over 5,000 men during its retreat through New York and New Jersey, and now had fewer than 5,000 able soldiers. That winter, one of the men in camp, Thomas Paine, would write The American Crisis, beginning with the famous words, "These are the times that try men's souls." After failing to bag Washington's army in New York, the British gave chase, but with the winter beginning, the British camped out on the New Jersey side of the Delaware River. In the 18th century, armies generally suspended their ongoing military campaigns during winter, allowing the colonists to plan ways to halt British momentum during the fighting months. A perfect example of that was Benedict Arnold's campaign to Quebec in 1775, which was a tactical defeat that succeeded in keeping the British in Canada from conducting a campaign until the spring of 1776. With a beaten-down army, American morale was low. Throughout all the colonies, many expressed doubts about the viability of the war. Washington knew he needed a big victory, after having spent the past 6 months suffering one defeat after the other. On the other hand, it seemed perfectly logical to camp out in Pennsylvania and wait until spring to resume fighting. But Washington's insistence on a big move was so resolute that he authorized an unorthodox decision on Christmas of 1776. On Christmas night, Washington led his troops across the frigid and partially frozen Delaware River. Once on the other side, they advanced south to Trenton, where they attacked, captured, and killed Hessian soldiers stationed there. The Hessians had celebrated Christmas and were completely unprepared for an attack. Only a handful of Americans were killed, while the Continental Army captured over 1,000 Hessian forces and killed nearly 100. The Battle of Trenton was indeed the decisive move Washington had hoped it would be. The British general, Lord Cornwallis, marched south from New York City through New Jersey to capture Trenton. Washington, however, moved to Cornwallis' rear and attacked the British at Princeton, New Jersey in January 1777, forcing the British to retreat to New York City for the rest of the winter. Despite the victory, however, Washington faced an unprecedented crisis. Apart from the men recruited in Massachusetts before the creation of the Second Continental Congress, Washington's army's one-year recruitment term was now up. With the end of the year 1776, much of Washington's army intended to finish. Washington had to urge Congress to make an important decision and extend enlistment terms. Fearing the creation of a permanent army, many in Congress feared making this decision. In the end, however, they approved enlistment terms of 3 years or until the war is finished. Crisis had been narrowly averted. The campaign plan that brought about the Battle of Saratoga came from the pen of Major General John Burgoyne. Burgoyne had returned to England in November 1776 after having spent his summer helping to expel the American forces under Benedict Arnold from the St. Lawrence Valley. In London, aside from spending a good amount of time at the gaming tables, Burgoyne composed Thoughts for Conducting the War from the Side of Canada, which proposed a change in British strategy. Rather than focusing on the New England region, Burgoyne proposed an invasion of New York from Canada, with a British force of about 7,000 strong moving south in a thrust. It aimed to capture Fort Ticonderoga, which Arnold had helped capture from the British in 1775. And from there, the British would move toward Albany. Meanwhile, British troops under General Sir William Howe would move from New York City to Albany, and together they would isolate New England. According to the plan, when the Americans under Washington moved from New Jersey to try to aid New England, Howe would crush the Continental Army and end the rebellion once and for all. In conclusion, Burgoyne wrote, "Should it appear, upon examination of the really effective numbers of the Canada Army, that the force is not sufficient for proceeding upon the above ideas with a fair prospect of success, the alternative remains of embarking the army at Quebec in order to effect a junction with General Howe by sea, or to be employed separately to cooperate with the main designs by such means as should be within their strength upon other parts of the continent. And though the army, upon examination of the numbers from the returns here, and the reinforcements designed, should appear adequate, it is humbly submitted, as a security against the possibility of its remaining inactive, whether it might not be expedient to entrust the latitude of embarking the army by sea to the commander-in-chief, provided any accidents during the winter, and unknown here, should have diminished the numbers considerably, or that the enemy, from any winter success to the southward, should have been able to draw such forces towards the frontiers of Canada, and take up their ground with such precaution, as to render the intended measure impracticable or too hazardous. But in that case, it must be considered that more force would be required to be left behind for the security of Canada than is supposed to be necessary when an army is beyond the lakes. And I do not conceive any expedition from the sea can be so formidable to the enemy, or so effectual to close the war, as an invasion from Canada by Ticonderoga. This measure ought not to be thought of, but upon positive conviction of its necessity." It helped that Burgoyne had friends in high places. While hunting, he handed a copy of his proposal to his companions, including King George III and Lord George Germain, the Secretary of State for the colonies. Germain accepted the plan and wrote General Sir Guy Carleton on March 26, 1777. "You will be informed, by the contents thereof, that as soon as you should have driven the rebel forces from the frontiers of Canada, it was His Majesty's pleasure that you should return to Quebec, and take with you such part of your army as in your judgment and discretion appeared sufficient for the defense of the province, that you should detach Lieutenant General Burgoyne, or such other officer as you should think most proper, with the remainder of the troops, and direct the officer so detached to proceed with all possible expedition to join General Howe, and to put himself under his command. With a view of quelling the rebellion as soon as possible, it has become highly necessary that the most speedy junction of the two armies should be effected, and therefore, as the security and good government of Canada absolutely require your presence there, it is the King's determination to leave about 3,000 men under your command for the defense and duties of that province, and to employ the remainder of your army upon two expeditions, the one under the command of Lieutenant General Burgoyne, who is to force his way to Albany, and the other under the command of Lieutenant Colonel St. Leger, who is to make a diversion on the Mohawk River. As this plan cannot be advantageously executed without the assistance of Canadians and Indians, His Majesty strongly recommends it to your care, to furnish both expeditions with good and sufficient bodies of those men, and I am happy in knowing that your influence among them is so great that there can be no room to apprehend you will find it difficult to fulfill His Majesty's expectations. As direct as Germain's orders to Carleton were, one critical individual was left out of the loop. That, unfortunately for the success of the entire operation, was General Howe. Richard Ketchum described the circumstances that left Howe completely in the dark concerning his role in Burgoyne's plan. Howe did receive a copy of the letter to Carleton, but nothing more specific. According to William Knox, one of Germain's undersecretaries, his lordship was on his way to the country when he stopped by the office to sign his mail and was reminded that nothing had been written to Howe specifying what action was expected of him. Lord George was annoyed. His carriage was waiting. He did not want his horses to be kept standing, and his tolerance for frustration was just about nil. He made it clear that he had no intention of spending another minute at the office, so Mr. Doyley, who handled traffic concerning the war, said he would prepare an order for the general and enclose the copy of Germain's letter to Carleton. But since Howe later denied having received any instructions, except the copy of the message to Carleton, it may be supposed that Doyley's order was nothing of the kind, but at most a note explaining the enclosure. Of considerably more importance than his missing dispatch is what Lord George neglected to tell Sir William. Given Germain's proclivity for giving his field commanders minutely detailed orders, it is incomprehensible that between March 3rd and April 19th, a period of 7 weeks, he wrote 8 letters to Howe and never once referred to the Burgoyne expedition or to what was expected from Howe in the way of cooperation. This meant that Howe's total knowledge of the joint operation was as described in Germain's letter to Carleton. If Howe failed to understand the purpose of the invasion from Canada, as he later claimed, Germain had no one but himself to blame. Instead, Howe would turn his forces against Philadelphia, an operation that Burgoyne was not aware of himself. The success of Burgoyne's entire operation depended on linking up with a force that was not going to be there, and Burgoyne would not know this until it was too late. The delicate job of delivering Germain's instructions to General Carleton was Burgoyne's. He sailed with Germain's letter from Portsmouth, England, on a ship bound for New York on March 28, 1777. Arriving in New York after a cruise of some weeks, he transferred to the frigate Apollo and supervised the loading of his personal baggage, which included an ample supply of champagne, claret, and brandy. After a wait of nearly 6 weeks, Burgoyne landed along the cliffs of Quebec on May 6, 1777. 10 days later, Burgoyne arrived at Montreal and took command of the British forces in Canada. The British forces under Burgoyne's new command, that were to participate in his invasion of New York, had been resupplied and retrained after repelling the American invasion of Quebec, another campaign headed in part by Arnold in early 1776. The British lacked enough horses, however, and that hampered their operations. About 3,700 men under Burgoyne were British regulars, many of whom were veterans of Quebec or had fought at Lexington, Concord, and Bunker Hill. There were about an equal number of German mercenaries. To move his men, Carleton had assembled 500 flat-bottomed boats, along with the gunboats and sailing vessels he had constructed to repel the Americans. Burgoyne also brought with him 138 artillery pieces, ranging from 3-pounders to large 24-pounders, along with 450 artillerymen to man them. Under Burgoyne were Major General William Phillips, leading the British forces, and Major General Frederick Baron von Riedesel, leading the German forces. Once the forces assembled, the expedition left Canada on June 13, 1777. In a letter to a friend, a young officer accompanying Burgoyne's expedition provided a vivid description of the British forces on the march. "I cannot forbear portraying to your imagination one of the most pleasing spectacles I ever beheld. When we were in the widest part of the lake, whose beauty and extent I have already described, it was remarkably fine and clear. Not a breeze was stirring, when the whole army appeared at one view in such perfect regularity as to form the most complete and splendid brigada you can possibly conceive. In the front, the Indians went with their birch-bark canoes, containing 20 or 30 each. Then they advanced corps in regular line with the gunboats, then followed the Royal George and Inflexible, towing large booms, which are to be thrown across 2 points of land, with the 2 brigs and sloops following, after them Generals Burgoyne, Phillips, and Riedesel in their pinnaces. Next to them the 2nd Battalion, followed by the German Battalion, and the rear was brought up with the settlers and followers of the army. Upon the appearance of so formidable a fleet, you may imagine they were not a little dismayed at Ticonderoga, for they were appraised of our advance, as we every day could see their watch-boats. Throughout the campaign, Burgoyne counted on assistance from Loyalists and the Native American tribes in New York to supplement his forces. However, as David Ellis noted, Burgoyne's assumptions proved wrong. The Canadians, they hoped, would volunteer out of gratitude for British help in repelling the American invasion of the previous year. But only 150 Canadians appeared. In 1775, the French-speaking Canadians had shown little desire to fight Yankee invaders, and obviously had even less interest in marching hundreds of miles south to put down a rebellion. New York had probably the highest proportion of Loyalists or Tories of the 13 colonies. Moreover, most Iroquois of the 6 nations followed Joseph Brant, the Mohawk chief. Burgoyne hoped for great and from these 2 groups. A few Tories from Vermont and New York drifted into his camp. They did give him precise information about the frontier settlements and the roads, but they added very little fighting strength. Indian scouts were indispensable as the eyes and ears of any expedition pushing its way through the wilderness. Burgoyne had hoped that as many as 1,000 warriors would join his force, but only some 400 showed up. The start of the campaign. While Burgoyne was preparing to march into New York and, he hoped, crush the American rebellion once and for all, the Americans were preparing for such an invasion. The Northern Division of the Continental Army was led by General Philip Schuyler, appointed by Congress in May to absolute command over every part of the Northern Department. Alan Walworth explained. On the 3rd of June, he arrived in Albany and resumed his command. During his absence, little had been done to carry forward his plans of defense, or to increase the little army that garrisoned the widely separated posts of the command. The Mohawk Valley, always an object of especial care and solicitude to Schuyler, had been wholly neglected. Upon his arrival in Albany, he immediately wrote to General Herkimer to hold the militia of Tryon County in readiness to repel any attack from the west, and he renewed his efforts to quiet and conciliate the Indians of the 6 nations, with whom he had great influence. When informed of Burgoyne's movements, Schuyler inferred, correctly, that the British were aiming to take back Fort Ticonderoga, although he incorrectly assumed that the movement was a feint to mask a thrust against New England. Thus, he worked to strengthen Ticonderoga's defenses, and on June 12, 1777, Schuyler appointed Major General Arthur St. Clair to take command of the fort. Schuyler appealed to Washington for reinforcements, asked for assistance from the governments of Massachusetts and Connecticut, and attempted to gather the New York militia. Washington, however, was concerned that Burgoyne's moves were designed to draw him away from Philadelphia, leaving it open to General Howe's forces. Walworth explained, "It is evident that the situation of the Northern Department constantly occupied the attention of the Commander-in-Chief. When he was assured that Howe was in the Capes of the Delaware, and there was no further doubt that Philadelphia was the point of attack, although himself in great need of troops and efficient officers, he parted with Morgan's corps of 500 picked men, and St. Arnold, of whose abilities as a general he entertained a high opinion, to assist the Army of the North. He also directed General Lincoln, then in New England, to repair to Schuyler's command, and advised that he should attempt a flank movement upon Burgoyne toward the east. He also addressed circulars to the Brigadier Generals of Militia in Western Massachusetts and Connecticut, urging them to march with a large part of their command to Saratoga, or other rendezvous designated by General Schuyler. To the latter, he wrote, warning him against collecting large quantities of ammunition and other stores in ports and lines of defense. "I begin to consider lines," he writes, "a kind of trap, unless they are in passes which cannot be avoided by the enemy." The scantiness of the garrison, the contentions among its commanders, and the final unexpected rapidity of Burgoyne's advance may partly explain the apparent want of sound military judgment that caused this fortress to fall like ripe fruit into the hands of the invader. Due to a series of miscommunications, Ticonderoga would prove more vulnerable than the rebels anticipated. Schuyler had appointed Anthony Wayne to command Fort Ticonderoga, which had a garrison of over 2,000 men, on November 18, 1776. Shortly after he arrived, Wayne wrote General Schuyler, "Dear General, I herewith send you a return of this garrison as also of the soldiers re-engaged to serve during the war, which are but few. Liberty to come down for 1 month when relieved carries with it an idea of being immediately sent back again to a place which they imagine to be very unhealthy. They say, march us off this ground, and then we will cheerfully re-engage. Add to this their anxiety about their friends in the Jerseys and Pens makes them impatient to be led to the assistance of their distressed country. They likewise see the eastern people running away in the clouds of the night, some before and all soon as their times expire. Colonel Whitcomb's regiment, all the sailors and mariners, the whole of the artificers and all the corps of artillery except Captain Roman's company, which consists but of 12 men, officers included, are gone off the ground, notwithstanding so bad an example, and the distress of their native state, the Pennsylvanians, will not leave me until fresh troops arrive to relieve them. Your own feelings, sir, on the alarming situation of affairs in Pennsylvania and Jersey will best inform you of that of every other officer and soldier from those states on the present occasion, which causes us most ardently to wish for an opportunity of meeting those sons of war in Rapine, face to face and man to man. These worthy fellows are second to none in courage. I have seen them proved, and I know that they are not far behind any regulars in point of discipline. Such troops, actuated by principle, and fired with just resentment, must be an acceptable, and perhaps seasonable reinforcement to General Washington at this critical juncture. If you should be of the same opinion, and cause us to be immediately relieved, with orders to march with all dispatch to join the main army, I believe we should be able to re-enlist the chief part of our people on the way. However, this may be, I would answer for it, that they will not turn aside from danger, although their term should be expired, when the safety and honor of their country require them to face it. I must once more earnestly request you to order up shoes and soap. We are much distressed for one of these necessary articles. Dr. McCrae arrived last night with some medicine, but hospital stores, roots, and vegetables we are totally destitute of." A short time later, Wayne appraised Schuyler of the situation of the fort, which he wrote of in stark terms, while complimenting the troops under his command. "Dear General, Colonel Simon's regiment, Colonel Robinson's regiment, consisting of about 700 men, officers included, are now arrived together with 24 men of Colonel Warner's regiment. In consequence, I have ordered one regiment of the Pennsylvania to march tomorrow. The others will follow as soon as possible, with orders to proceed in good order to Philadelphia. I have lately received letters from General St. Clair and other gentlemen in General Washington's camp, which made me think it advisable to keep these regiments embodied until they are dismissed by the Board of War. Their time expired the 5th of this instant. They are to be settled within Philadelphia agreeable to promise. When I have reason to expect the greatest part will re-engage, I want much to go also. It would be in my power to do more with them in case of necessity than perhaps any other officer. I know these worthy fellows well, and they know me. I am confident they would not desert me in a time of danger. If you think it would be for the benefit of the service, I should be glad to be immediately relieved in command with orders to march with the last of the Southern troops. For the present, I am using every effort to render this place strong. I shall soon complete the abattis round the old fort, and octagons on Mount Independence, and two new blockhouses, so that in a few days we hope to render this post tenable and leave it in a much securer and better state than we found it. The manner in which I have kept our guards and sentries, and the constant succession of scouts which I have out, if followed by my successor, will effectually prevent a surprise. You will please to order the other troops destined for this garrison to be forwarded with all possible dispatch. In February 1777, Wayne wrote to his friend Sharp Delaney, "I must now, in confidence, tell you that this post has been most shamefully neglected. All the old and good troops are gone, none here but a few wretched militia, badly armed and worse disciplined. This garrison at this time ought to consist of at least 5,000 effective men, with a well-trained corps of artillery. Perhaps Congress thinks it does. I have not one-fifth part of that number on the ground, and I would much rather risk my life, reputation, and the fate of America on 400 good troops than the whole of the present garrison. This is the situation of the second post in the United States. The neighboring governments are now roused, and I expect in a few days to be strongly reinforced. A body of the enemy were discovered a few days since marching this way by two Canadians, who are gone to Albany. This has awaked General Schuyler and others, whose business it was to send troops, from their lethargy. We may probably have some diversion in a few hours. I have yet some good men on whom I can depend, and I will be answerable for the maintenance of this post until succor can arrive." Although Wayne wrote pessimistically about the conditions at Ticonderoga in letters to acquaintances, he was still confident that the position could not be taken by the British without a bloody fight, and he expressed that to his superiors. In part because of that confidence, Wayne would be ordered to leave the fort in early 1777 to help Washington elsewhere. That ended up weakening Ticonderoga months before Burgoyne's forces landed at Crown Point, 10 miles north of Ticonderoga, in late June 1777. There, on June 30th, Burgoyne issued an order to his men, "The army embarks tomorrow to approach the enemy. We are to contend for the King and the Constitution of Great Britain, to vindicate the law, and to relieve the oppressed, a cause in which His Majesty's troops and those of the princes his allies will feel equal excitement. The services required of this particular expedition are critical and conspicuous. During our progress, occasions may occur, in which nor difficulty, nor labor, nor lies are to be regarded. This army must not retreat." Burgoyne advanced toward Ticonderoga, capturing Mount Hope, the mills at the outlet of Lake George, and Sugar Hill on July 4th. Under the cover of darkness, Burgoyne's forces moved their artillery into place, and on the morning of July 5th, St. Clair and the Americans could see the British busy at work constructing an artillery battery on Mount Defiance, 700 feet above Fort Ticonderoga. The Americans had long been aware of Mount Defiance's commanding position, but nobody had bothered to man it or defend it, wrongly assuming the British could not haul artillery up there. However, as British Major General William Phillips succinctly put it, "Where a goat can go, a man can go, and where a man can go, he can drag a gun." Seeing no alternative but to evacuate the position once the British manned Fort Defiance, St. Clair quietly ordered an orderly retreat under the guise of making a sortie against the British forces. Over the next couple of days, the American forces managed to escape. Burgoyne came into possession of Fort Ticonderoga, but he had not crushed the enemy as he had hoped. Burgoyne reported the capture of Ticonderoga to Germain in a letter dated July 11, 1777. "I have the honor to inform your lordship that the enemy, dislodged from Ticonderoga and Mount Independence on the 6th instant, and were driven on the same day beyond Skeensborough on the right and to Humerton on the left, with a loss of 128 pieces of cannon, all their armed vessels and bateaux, the greatest part of their baggage and ammunition, provision, and military stores to a very large amount. This success has been followed by events equally fortunate and rapid. I subjoin such a detail of circumstances as the time will permit. And for His Majesty's further information, I beg leave to refer your lordship to Captain Gardner, my aide-de-camp, whom I thought it necessary to dispatch with news so important to the King's service and so honorable to the troops under my command. Although it was a clear British victory, as they had on repeated occasions, the American forces survived to fight another day. The remnants of St. Clair's command made their way through the forests of northern New York to meet up with Schuyler's force at Albany, and many of them would be on hand to fight around Saratoga. After hearing that St. Clair had evacuated Ticonderoga, Schuyler thought the worst and was relieved when St. Clair and his tired and haggard force arrived at Fort Edward. Walworth described the mood in the American camp. These misfortunes in the beginning of the campaign involved a heavy loss of artillery, small arms, and stores of all kinds. The consternation of the people who fled before Burgoyne seemed still more disastrous, and Schuyler's fortitude and composure were most severely tried. He was sustained and encouraged by constant dispatches from Washington, who writes at one time, "We should never despair. If new difficulties arise, we must only put forth new exertions." And again he expresses an earnest sympathy for Schuyler amid these thickening difficulties, and manifests his unwavering confidence in his ability to overcome them. With unflagging energy, Schuyler exerted himself to delay the enemy while endeavoring to collect a sufficient force to meet him with some reasonable prospect of success. Schuyler remained at Fort Edward until his forces had blocked the passages from Skenesboro, where Burgoyne lingered at camp. Walworth noted, "Huge stones were rolled into Wood Creek, and trees felled across it. Bridges were destroyed, and the forests leveled across the roads. The surrounding country was stripped of forage, and the cattle driven off, so that the enemy would be compelled to rely upon his base of operations for provisions." These obstacles forced Burgoyne to have men spend about 2 weeks cutting a road for his heavy artillery from Skenesboro to Fort Edward. Naturally, by the time Burgoyne's forces reached Fort Edward, Schuyler's forces were gone. In the wake of yet another retreat, the morale of American forces had reached a low ebb. The constant retreats made the men uneasy about their own leaders and uncertain of their own fighting capacity. Dozens of men deserted the army each day, to the extent that by August 1st, only about 4,000 men were left, many of whom were boys, old men, and black servants. The Americans needed a rallying cry, and it would soon arrive. In the vicinity of Fort Edward lived a Tory widow, Sarah McNeil, who awaited the arrival of her cousin, General Simon Fraser, who was with Burgoyne's forces. Living with McNeil was a young woman, a beautiful 23-year-old named Jane McCrae. McCrae herself was waiting for her fiancé, a local boy named David Jones, who had run away to Canada to serve with the British. On July 27th, McNeil arrived at Burgoyne's camp in the company of two of the British side's naval allies, alleging that Jane had been killed and scalped by the two. In his journal of the campaign, Lieutenant William Digby wrote about the incident. "In the evening, our Indians brought in two scalps, one of them an officer's, which they danced about in their usual manner. Indeed, the cruelties committed by them were too shocking to relate, particularly the melancholy catastrophe of the unfortunate Miss McCrae, which affected the general and the whole army with the sincerest regret and concern for her untimely fate. This young lady was about 18, had a pleasing person, her family were loyal to the king, and she engaged to be married to a provincial officer in our army before the war broke out. Our Indians, I may well now call them savages, were detached on scouting parties, both in out front and on our flanks, and came to the house where she resided. But the scene is too tragic for my pen. She fell a sacrifice to the savage passions of these bloodthirsty monsters. I make no doubt, but the censorious world, who seldom judge but by outward appearances, will be apt to censure General Burgoyne for the cruelties committed by his Indians, and imagine he countenanced them in so acting. On the contrary, I am pretty certain it was always against his desire to give any assistance to the savages. When word of McCrae's death arrived at General Horatio Gates' headquarters, he wrote Burgoyne that the savages of America should in their warfare mangle and scalp the unhappy prisoners who fall into their hands is neither new nor extraordinary, but that the famous Lieutenant General Burgoyne, in whom the fine gentleman is united with the soldier and the scholar, should hire the savages of America to scalp Europeans and the descendants of Europeans, nay more that he should pay a price for each scalp so barbarously taken, is more than will be believed in England until authenticated facts shall in every gazette convince mankind of the truth of this horrid tale. Miss McCrae, a young lady lovely to the sight, a virtuous character and amiable disposition, engaged to be married to an officer in your army, was with other women and children taken out of a house near Fort Edward, carried into the woods, and there scalped and mangled in the most shocking manner. Two parents with their six children were all treated with the same inhumanity while quietly residing in their once happy and peaceful dwelling. The miserable fate of Miss McCrae was partly aggravated by her being dressed to receive her promised husband, but met her murderers employed by you. Upwards of 100 men, women, and children have perished by the hands of these ruffians, to whom it is asserted you have paid the price of blood. Burgoyne replied, "It has happened that all my transactions with the Indian nations last year and this have been open, clearly heard, distinctly understood, and accurately minuted by very numerous, and in many parts very prejudiced audiences. So diametrically opposite to truth is your assertion that I have paid a price for scalps, that one of the first regulations established by me at the Great Council in May, and repeated and enforced, and invariably adhered to since, was that the Indians should receive compensation for prisoners, because it would prevent cruelty, and that not only such compensation should be withheld, but a strict account demanded for scalps. These pledges of conquest, for such you well know they will ever esteem them, were solemnly and peremptorily prohibited to be taken from the wounded, and even the dying, and the persons of aged men, women, and children, and prisoners were pronounced sacred even in assaults. Respecting Miss McCrae, her fall wanted not the tragic display you have labored to give it, to make it as sincerely abhorred and lamented by me as it can possibly be by the tenderest of her friends. The fact was no premeditated barbarity. On the contrary, two chiefs who had brought her up for the purpose of security, not of violence to her person, disputed who should be her guard, and in a fit of savage passion in the one from whose hand she was snatched, the unhappy woman became the victim. Upon the first intelligence of the events, I obliged the Indians to deliver the murderer into my hands, and though to have punished him by our laws and principles of justice would have been perhaps unprecedented, he certainly should have suffered an ignominious death, had I not been convinced, by circumstances and observation beyond the possibility of a doubt, that a pardon under the terms I prescribed and they accepted would be more efficacious than an execution to prevent similar mischiefs. The above instance excepted, your intelligence respecting cruelties of the Indians is absolutely false. You seem to threaten me with European publications, which affect me as little as any other threats you could make. But in regard to American publications, whether the charge against me, which I acquit you of believing, was penciled from a gazette or for a gazette, I desire and demand of you, as a man of honor, that should it appear in print at all, this answer may follow it. In spite of Burgoyne's protest, the American press publicized McCrae's death as an example of the barbarity of the British, not just their native allies. David Wilson wrote in The Life of Jane McCrae, published in 1853, "The account of this dreadful tragedy at once circulated far and wide over the land, and everywhere excited the liveliest emotions of sympathy. By every fireside, in public assemblies, in the national councils, it was told and retold, until the story of Jane McCrae was known throughout the continent. It was the subject of songs and ballads. It crossed the Atlantic and was caught up by those who had opposed the war. In the House of Commons, while denouncing the ministry for having employed savages in the struggle against the colonies, Burke repeated it with all the vehemence, arid power that characterized his glowing eloquence. It spread still farther, through France, Germany, Italy, and over all the nations of Europe that recognized the rules of civilized warfare, and the inhumanity of England in making allies of barbarians, who could be guilty of such atrocious and cruel acts, was everywhere condemned. Among the patriots, the murder of the defenseless girl excited emotions of unappeasable indignation. The indignation prompted hundreds of men to flock to the militia to join the fight against Burgoyne's invasion. Bennington. By this point, Burgoyne was beginning to have bigger problems than simply the rising anger of the Americans against the British and their native allies. One of the most famous military maxims attributed to Napoleon is that an army marches on its stomach, and to say the logistics of supplying British forces proved difficult would be an understatement. Given the fact that supply lines were dependent on Canada and England, supplying Burgoyne's forces would be just as difficult as executing a massive invasion of the colonies. Indeed, by the time the first phase of his envisioned campaign had ended, Burgoyne faced a dilemma. In his history of the battle, Richard Ketchum noted that Burgoyne had not the slightest doubt that his army would overrun the rebels and reach Albany, but his decision to sit tight at Skenesboro was based on a number of considerations. Nor was the time the realities of a wilderness campaign conducted far from a base hit home like a blow to the stomach, and what had seemed simple when he studied his options on a map in London began to take on a daunting complexity. The Army's real base of operations was Canada, and although departments or magazines, as they were called, had been established along the way, the round trip for ships sailing back and forth was painfully slow, even with no enemy vessels to oppose them. The business of furnishing food, ammunition, and other necessities for a force of some 7,000 men, plus women, camp followers, and heaven only knew how many animals, was beginning to assume awesome proportions, if for no reason other than the length of the supply line and the time it took for an essential item to travel from Montreal or Quebec to Skenesboro or beyond. The general dared not order his entire army to march until he was satisfied that he had an adequate store of everything on hand and a fully operative, reliable system for supplying the army's needs on a regular basis. Given these problems, Ketchum pointed out that Burgoyne could not know it, but the days of rapid forward movement and lightning successes were over. While Burgoyne's advance on Albany stalled, another British force was marching into New York from Canada from the west. A force of 300 British regulars and 650 Canadian and Loyalist militia, led by Lieutenant Colonel Barry St. Leger, crossed Lake Ontario and took Oswego without incident. There, St. Leger's force was joined by 1,000 natives. From Oswego, St. Leger's force marched on July 25th to Port Stanwix, and the British began to lay siege to that fort on August 2nd. A force of American militia and their native allies, led by General Nicholas Herkimer, marched to relieve the siege, but they were ambushed by the British and their native allies on August 6th at Oriskany. Henry Cookenham explained, "At the ravine in the dense forest, 2 miles beyond the Oriskany Creek, were concealed some 500 British soldiers, Canadians and Tories, and as many Indians under the great leader, Thayendanegea. Unconscious of danger, the patriots passed along the rough woods road into the ravine. Suddenly 1,000 rifles cracked. The air about them was filled with smoke, and the yells of the Indians reverberated through the forest. Surprised, appalled, staggered, the 800 patriots were thrown into confusion. But their commander did not lose his self-control, and, with courage unsurpassed, he rallied his men and sent back a well-directed fire. Early in the conflict, General Herkimer was wounded, and then, seated upon the ground, with courage, than which none is greater, he directed the battle to the end. The fierceness of this struggle was never surpassed in modern warfare. Of the 800 patriots who participated in the fight, less than 200 remained unscathed when the retreat began after the battle was over. The loss upon the side of the enemy, as reported by St. Leger, was 300. But this, probably, does not include the loss among the Indians, which was very great, as Joseph Brant, the Indonesia, many times after referred to the suffering of his poor Mohawks in this conflict. During the battle, there was a sortie from Fort Stanwix led by Colonel Willett, the second in command, and it was most successful in capturing the camp of Sir John Johnson, a vast amount of property, and the order book of Sir John. On August 10th, a force of 800 men led by Benedict Arnold left Stillwater, New York, and marched toward Fort Stanwix. Arriving at Fort Dayton on August 21st, Arnold was only able to recruit a further 100 militiamen to continue the march. Resorting to subterfuge, Arnold released a Loyalist prisoner with information tricking St. Leger into thinking that Arnold's force was much larger than it actually was. Upon receiving this news, St. Leger's native allies withdrew from Fort Stanwix, taking the remaining supplies with them. Left in the New York wilderness without adequate supplies, St. Leger was forced to abandon the siege of the fort and lead his hungry men back to Quebec. With that, Burgoyne's campaign, which relied on a three-pronged thrust, was down to a one-pronged thrust. Burgoyne would only begin to realize this when a messenger from General Howe arrived at Fort Edward on August 3rd, bringing a letter written on July 17th. I have received yours of the 2nd instant on the 15th, have since heard from the rebel army of your being in possession of Ticonderoga, which is a great event, carried without loss. I have received your two letters from Plymouth and Quebec, your last of the 14th May, and shall observe the contents. There is a report of a messenger of yours to me having been taken, and the letter discovered in a double wooden canteen. You will know if it was of any consequence. Nothing of it has transpired to us. I will observe the same rules in writing to you, as you propose, in your letters to me. Washington is waiting our motions here, and has detached Sullivan with about 2,500 men, as I learned, to Albany. My intention is for Pennsylvania, where I expect to meet Washington. But if he goes to the northward contrary to my expectations, and you can keep him at bay, be assured I shall soon be after him to relieve you. After your arrival at Albany, the movements of the enemy will guide yours, but my wishes are that the enemy be drove out of this province before any operation takes place in Connecticut. Sir Henry Clinton remains in command here and will act as occurrence as my direct. Putnam is in the Highlands with about 4,000 men. This was obviously not good news for Burgoyne. Not only would Howe's forces not be able to reinforce his troops at Albany, but this meant Howe could not be relied on to bring additional supplies for Burgoyne's forces. Concerned that the supply situation was only going to become more serious, Burgoyne decided to act on a suggestion of Baron von Riedesel. Burgoyne decided to act on a suggestion that Baron von Riedesel had made in July to send a force east towards the New Hampshire Grants and western Massachusetts, present-day Vermont, to forage for supplies and capture draft animals and other resources to supplement the British. Thus, Burgoyne sent Colonel Frederick Baum's regiment to that area, but on August 16th, Baum's forces were met by a force of New Hampshire militia, led by John Stark at Bennington. Samuel Bartlett would later write of the ensuing battle. The morning of the 16th opened in absolute beauty. Not a cloud, not a stirring leaf. Raindrops glittered like diamonds in the trees. The river alone seemed alive as it rolled along, swollen and tumultuous. The German officer never forgot that beautiful scene. For hours not an enemy had been seen, nor a sound of alarm had been heard. All was so peaceful that the leaders grew competent, and breakfast was ordered preparatory to action. But it was the hush of the crouching catamount. Scarcely were the haversacks unslung and the muskets piled when the men were called in all haste to their ranks. That same officer, Glitch, looking out from his zigzag breastwork on the hill, to his amazement saw the pickets retiring, the outposts withdrawing, and a strange body of men emerging from the thicket behind. He watched in alarm as they marched and countermarched conspicuously in sight. Two of their officers rode forth to reconnoiter, and as the British cannoneer fired his harmless shot, he did not know that he aimed at Warner and Stark. Suddenly, Glitch heard a trampling behind in the forest on the right. It was Herrick and his rangers in their uniform of green. Then came a shout and a rattling fire in the rear on the left. It was Nichols, of Amherst, giving the signal to begin. From before sunrise, they had wound in single file through the forest, and now with a green twig in every hatband they came forth. Scarcely had the sound of the first fire died out when the Indians broke and fled. A column pushed forward on the Tory breastwork on this side of the river. It was Stickney and Hobart, and for a badge every man had a cornhusk in his hat. At the same signal, the main body moved up in front, and the battle raged on every side. And as they climbed the slippery steep, behind them came rolling down beneath the shots of our marksmen. For 2 hours, from 3 to 5 o'clock, the fire was one continuous roar. Those death-dealing columns closed in nearer and nearer. At 8 paces distance, they picked off the cannoneers from their guns. Still nearer they came until the flashes met. The ammunition cart exploded within the entrenchments, and at the sound our men rushed up, scaled the breastworks, and leaped down within. Then came a terrible clashing of sword and gunstock and bayonet. Gigantic John McNeil struck down 4 Hessians with the butt of his gun. In 5 minutes, 20 men broke through to the forest. The rest were all prisoners, or dead or dying. They fought gallantly, and their leader died a soldier's death. Total German and British losses at Bennington were recorded at 207 dead and 700 captured, while American losses included 30 dead and 40 wounded. The American victory at Bennington, when combined with the death of Jane McRae, proved a rallying cry for the Patriots, and the fighting also soured relations between Burgoyne and his native and Canadian allies. As a result, most of the native allies abandoned Burgoyne's camp, leaving his force with little protection from American rangers who lurked in the surrounding forests and harassed his men. Burgoyne's position was increasingly challenging. Freeman's Farm. While Burgoyne's invasion had stalled, Congress was still full of panic in Philadelphia, and the chief beneficiary of these concerns was Horatio Gates. Congress was shocked by the fall of Ticonderoga, and Gates voiced concerns about generals reluctant to confront the enemy head-on. While referring to Schuyler, Gates was also inferentially referring to Washington. At this time, Washington's main concern was preserving the Continental Army as a fighting force. And given the odds, the commander-in-chief carefully avoided a direct confrontation with the British unless there was clear numerical superiority. Some in Congress had grown impatient with this strategy, yearning for a decisive battle that would win the country's independence outright, despite the fact the Continental Army lacked the numbers, training, and resources to defeat the most professional army in the world. As a result, in response to Ticonderoga and Gates' assertions, Congress overrode the objections of the New York delegation and appointed Gates commander of the Northern Department on August 10th. Arriving in Albany on August 19th, Gates quickly alienated Schuyler, who soon departed for Philadelphia. Throughout August and September, militia companies from Pennsylvania and Massachusetts joined the Continental Army along the Hudson, and Washington ordered troops under Arnold to augment Gates' forces. These men were rallied to the cause by the outrage over Jane McRae's death and the successes at Bennington and Fort Stanwix. These forces swelled Gates' ranks to over 6,000 men by the middle of September, which rivaled Burgoyne's numbers. Walworth summarized Burgoyne's actions leading up to the Battle of Saratoga. The defeat of Baum and the failure of St. Leger by successive strokes had paralyzed the right and the left arms of Burgoyne's force, and he now struggled forward with the main body of his army, amid ever-thickening danger. Yet undismayed, he assiduously endeavored to carry out his original design and obey the orders of Germain and the king. Having collected provisions for 30 days' march, he dispatched a messenger to New York with entreaties for a movement to be made from that direction. He then left Durer's house and moved his army steadily forward to the Baton Kill, where he encamped on the night of the 12th of September. Finding that his officers were reluctant to cross the river, he assumed the entire responsibility himself, and on the 13th and 14th, passed the whole army over the Hudson on a bridge of boats, enforcing his order. This army must not retreat. They continued their march down the river and encamped on the north side of Fish Creek. Here, in sight of Old Saratoga, which lay on the south side of the stream, closed the second period of the campaign. And with dramatic propriety, the curtain falls upon another act, which in its progress has already indicated the direction of coming events. Here also, on the night of the 14th of September, Burgoyne's encampment rested on the very spot where, a few weeks later, his surrender took place. This place was several miles above the battlefield of Bemis Heights. From a hill on the east side of the Hudson, Colonel Colburn, of the Continental Army, reconnoitered this camp. Perched in the porch of a tall tree, he counted through his field glass 800 tents, watched the army prepare for and start on its forward march, and then hastened to Stillwater to make his report to Gates. Burgoyne's orders betrayed his growing anxiety amid his determination to press onward with his plan of attack. On September 14th, he told his men, "During the next marches of the army, the corps are to move in such a state as to be fit for instant action. It is a standing order for the rest of the campaign that all pickets and guards are under arms an hour before daylight, and remain so until it is completely light." The next day, he said, "The army are to march in three columns after having passed Schuyler's house. The provisions to be floated down under the care of Captain Brown. The hospitals to move as quick as carts can be provided for them. The bridge to be broke up and floated down immediately after the army is marched." The organization of Burgoyne's forces was as follows. The Advanced Corps, also called Fraser's Corps, commanded by Brigadier General Simon Fraser. British Light Infantry Battalion, Major Alexander Lindsay, 6th Earl of Balcarres. British Grenadier Battalion, Major John Dyke Ackland. 24th Regiment of Foot, Major William Agnew. 3rd Battalion, 7th Company Royal Regiment of Artillery, augmented by British infantrymen of the Advanced Corps, consisting of 4 6-pounders, 4 3-pounders, and 2 5.5-inch Royal Howitzers. Captain Ellis Walker. Major Campbell's Department, also called the Indian Department, commanded by Major John Campbell. Company of British Marksmen, Fraser's Rangers, Captain Alexander Fraser. Company of Quebec Militia, Captain René Amabel Boucher de Boucherville. Company of Montreal Militia, Captain David Monin. Fort Hunter, Mohawk Warriors and Families, Chief John Desserontian. Iroquoian and Algonquian Seven Nations of Canada Warriors. The right wing of the army, also called the British Line, commanded by Brigadier General James Hamilton. 9th Regiment of Foot, Lieutenant Colonel John Hill. 21st Regiment of Foot, or Royal North British Fusiliers, Major George Forster. 62nd Regiment of Foot, Lieutenant Colonel John Anstruther. 20th Regiment of Foot, Lieutenant Colonel John Lind. Royal Regiment of Artillery Brigade of 4 6-pounders, Captain Thomas Jones. The left wing of the army, also called von Riedesel's division, commanded by Major General Friedrich Adolf Baron von Riedesel, Baron von Riedesel's general staff, Brunswick Dragoon Regiment Prinz Ludwig, Captain Adolf von Schlagentuffel, Princely Hessen-Hanau Artillery Corps, consisting of 4 6-pounders, Captain George Pausch, 1st German Brigade, commanded by Brigadier Johann Friedrich Specht, Brunswick Musketeer Regiment von Riedesel, Lieutenant Colonel Ernst Ludwig Wilhelm von Speth, Brunswick Musketeer Regiment Specht, Major Karl Friedrich von Ehrenkrug, Brunswick Musketeer Regiment von Retz, Major Balthasar Boguslaus von Loki, 2nd German Brigade, commanded by Brigadier Wilhelm Rudolf von Gall, Hessen-Hanau Musketeer Regiment, Herb Prinz, Colonel and Brigadier Wilhelm Rudolf von Gall. The Reserve Corps, also called Breiman's Corps, commanded by Lieutenant Colonel Heinrich Christoph Breiman. Brunswick Grenadier Battalion, Captain Albrecht Daniel von Lunesin. Brunswick Light Infantry Battalion von Barner, Captain Maximilian Christian Schotelius. Princely Hessen-Hanau Artillery Corps Detachment of 2 6-pounders, Bombardier Conrad Wall. The Brigade of the Park of Artillery, commanded by Captain John Carter. 1st Battalion, 8th Company Royal Regiment of Artillery, Captain and Major Griffith Williams. 1st Battalion, 5th Company Royal Regiment of Artillery, Captain John Carter. Royal Irish Regiment of Artillery Detachment. Additional Company of the 33rd Regiment of Foot, Lieutenant George Anson Nutt. Right Division, commanded by 2nd Lieutenant Samuel Remington, 2 12-pounders and 2 6-pounders. Center Division, commanded by Captain Lieutenant Thomas Bloomfield, 2 24-pounders, 2 8-inch howitzers, and 2 5.5-inch Royal Howitzers. Left Division, commanded by Captain Lieutenant Thomas Halsmer, 2 12-pounders and 2 6-pounders. Loyalist Infantry, often serving with the Advanced Corps. The King's Loyal Americans, Jessup's Rangers, Lieutenant Colonel Commandant Ebenezer Jessup, recruited from Loyalists in Charlotte County, New York, which encompassed present-day Clinton, Essex, Franklin, and Warren counties, Upper Washington County, and about one-third of Upper Vermont. The Queen's Loyal Rangers, Peters Corps, Lieutenant Colonel Commandant John Peters, recruited from Loyalists in Albany County, New York, encompassing present-day Albany, Columbia, Rensselaer, Saratoga, Schenectady, Schoharie counties, much of Greene and Washington counties, and Bennington County, Vermont. The Local Volunteers, Captain Samuel McKay. Volunteers under the command of Daniel McAlpin. Captain Daniel McAlpin. Captain Samuel Adams Company raised for the purpose of Rangers. Captain Samuel Adams. Also included with Burgoyne's force was a corps of engineers, charged with erecting battlements and fortified positions, and a detachment of sailors from the Royal Navy, which was responsible for manning the bateau that had transported the British forces from Canada. By September 18th, advanced units of his army reached a position just north of Saratoga, only 4 miles from the American lines. What Burgoyne did not know, in the absence of reliable Indian scouting, was that Gates was waiting for him in force to the south of Saratoga. On September 8th, Gates had ordered his army, which had ballooned to about 10,000 men, to march to Stillwater to set up a defensive position there. His engineer, Thaddeus Kosciusko, decided that the town itself was not defensible, so the poll chose Bemis Heights, 4 miles above Stillwater, as the most favorable position. Gates' army soon set up camp at that place, and construction began on a line of defensive entrenchments. Within a period of a week, Kosciusko altered the earthworks and positioned heavy weaponry into a strong array of defenses, and Walworth described the American position. The position chosen for the American camp, where Gates had determined to await an attack, was on a spur of hills that approached the riverbank. At their base, on the river, stood Bemis House, used by Gates as headquarters for a few days. He afterwards moved on the hill. Earthworks were thrown across the narrow meadow between the hill and the river. They covered the old road and the bridge of boats communicating with the east side of the Hudson. The heights were to the north and west. Breastworks were projected toward the north in a semicircle for 3/4 of a mile. Redoubts were established in intervals. A barn built of heavy logs belonging to the Nielsen farm, which lay within the works, was converted into a rude but strong fortification. A thickly wooded ravine formed a natural defense along the front of the camp, and Mill Creek swept through a deeper ravine a little to the north. Gates occupied, with the right wing, the river hills and the defile between these and the river. Morgan, of Arnold's division, the left wing, camped on the heights nearly a mile back from the river, and Learned occupied the elevated plain as center. Gates took command of the American right, to the east, while he put Arnold in command of the army's left, on the western part of Bemis Heights. Arnold's troops, numbering some 1,500 men, skirmished with Burgoyne's forces constantly, forcing the British general to assign a whole regiment to guard a small working party. Arnold soon alienated Gates, however, when he chose friends of Schuyler to staff his command. This immediately led to tensions between the two generals. The organization of the Continental Army under Gates facing Burgoyne, as of September 19, 1777, was as follows. The left wing of the army, also called Arnold's division, commanded by Major General Benedict Arnold. Benedict Arnold's general staff. Morgan's corps, commanded by Colonel Daniel Morgan. The Rifle Regiment, Corps of Riflemen, Lieutenant Colonel Richard Butler. The Corps of Light Infantry, Major Henry Dearborn. Poor's Brigade, commanded by Brigadier General Enoch Poor. 1st New Hampshire Regiment, Colonel Joseph Silly. 2nd New Hampshire Regiment, Lieutenant Colonel Winburn Adams. 3rd New Hampshire Regiment, Colonel Alexander Scammell. 2nd New York Regiment, Colonel Philip Van Cortlandt. 4th New York Regiment, Colonel Henry Beekman Livingston. Battalion of Connecticut Militia, Colonel Thaddeus Cook. Battalion of Connecticut Militia, Colonel Jonathan Latimer. Learned's Brigade, commanded by Brigadier General Ebenezer Learned. Colonel John Bailey's, later 2nd Massachusetts Bay Regiment, Colonel John Bailey. Colonel Michael Jackson's, later 8th Massachusetts Bay Regiment, Lieutenant Colonel John Brooks. Colonel James Wesson's, later 9th Massachusetts Bay Regiment, Colonel James Wesson. Battalion of Forces in the Service of the United States of America, former 1st Canadian Regiment, Colonel James Livingston. The right wing of the army, commanded by Major General Horatio Gates. Patterson's Brigade, commanded by Brigadier General John Patterson. Colonel Thomas Marshall's, later 10th Massachusetts Bay Regiment, Colonel Thomas Marshall. Colonel Ebenezer Francis, later 11th Massachusetts Bay Regiment, Colonel Benjamin Tupper. Colonel Samuel Brewer's, later 12th Massachusetts Bay Regiment, Colonel Samuel Brewer. Colonel Gamaliel Bradford's, later 14th Massachusetts Bay Regiment, Colonel Gamaliel Bradford. Nixon's Brigade, commanded by Brigadier General John Nixon. Colonel John Grayton's, later 3rd, Massachusetts Bay Regiment, Colonel John Grayton. Colonel Rufus Putnam's, later 5th, Massachusetts Bay Regiment. Colonel Rufus Putnam. Colonel Thomas Nixon's, later 6th, Massachusetts Bay Regiment. Colonel Thomas Nixon. Colonel Ichabod Alden's, later 7th, Massachusetts Bay Regiment. Lieutenant Colonel William Stacy. Glover's Brigade, commanded by Brigadier General John Glover. Colonel Joseph Bose's, later 1st, Massachusetts Bay Regiment. Colonel Joseph Bose. Colonel William Shepard's, later 4th, Massachusetts Bay Regiment. Colonel William Shepard. Colonel Edward Wigglesworth's, later 13th, Massachusetts Bay Regiment. Major John Porter. Colonel Timothy Bigelow's, later 15th, Massachusetts Bay Regiment. Major David Bradish. Battalion of Albany County, New York Militia, the 1st Regiment, Colonel Abraham Wemple. Battalion of Albany County, New York Militia, the 2nd Regiment, Colonel William Whiting. Battalion of Dutchess and Ulster County, New York Militia, Colonel Morris Graham. In addition, Gates had 2 organizations of cavalry, the 2nd Troop of the 2nd Continental Dragoons, commanded by Captain Jean-Louis de Vernageau, and the 2nd Regiment of Connecticut Light Horse, commanded by Major Elijah Hyde. One limitation Gates continued to have, when compared to Burgoyne's force, was artillery. For the entire American Army at Saratoga, there was 1 provisional artillery battalion, consisting of 1 9-pounder, 4 6-pounders, 4 15-pounders, and 2 3-pounders. Over the course of September 13th and 14th, Burgoyne crossed his army to the right bank of the Hudson and encamped at Schuylerville, the heights above Saratoga. On the 15th, having gotten his artillery and baggage across the river, Burgoyne moved south as far as Coville. There, he had his army halt for 2 days to repair the roads and bridges ahead to continue his advance toward the American lines. Burgoyne commenced his march on the 17th, and on that day, Arnold took 1,500 men out to harass the British lines and slow their advance. Charles Nielsen, in his account of the Saratoga campaign, noted that, because the country at that time was so thickly wooded, and the land along the river hills in their vicinity so cut up with deep and almost impassable ravines as to render it impracticable to attack him in flank, and to attack so powerful an army in front would not have been advisable, consequently he returned without accomplishing anything, excepting some slight skirmishing with the British advance guard. By the 18th, Burgoyne's army had reached a point called Wilbur's Basin, an elevated area that was 5 miles northeast of the American camp. There, he set up a fortified position within 2 miles of the American lines. Nielsen explained that Gates fortified his camp with breastworks and redoubts, in a line extending from the river to a range of hills about 40 rods distant, and upon which, and the plain in the rear, was posted the division under General Fraser, and upon the very ground, beneath the surface of which, the bones of that gallant officer are now moldering into dust. Opposite the British, Nielsen described how Gates lined up his own forces opposite the British. The main body, composing the right wing, and under the immediate command of General Gates, occupied the river hills, and the defile between those and the river, the left wing, under General Arnold, and composed of General Poor's brigade, Morgan's rifle regiment, and a portion of the militia, were posted on the heights about 3/4 of a mile in rear of the river hills, and General Learned, with his brigade and 2 regiments of militia, occupied the plain or center. On the morning of September 19th, Burgoyne advanced towards the Americans in 3 columns, with Baron von Riedesel commanding the left, Burgoyne taking the center, and Fraser moving far to the west. Burgoyne's aim was for Fraser's force and his force to unite in the rear of the left wing of the American camp. hoping that while the Canadians and Indians distracted the American forces in the front, Fraser would get into the rear of the Americans. Burgoyne would simultaneously attack the front, and Riedesel would occupy Gates on the American right. Nielsen described Burgoyne's advance on the Americans. About 10 o'clock, the British troops formed themselves in order of march, with a full determination of forcing their way through the American lines, and made their arrangements accordingly. Burgoyne's intention, as was afterwards authentically ascertained, with the center division, of which he took command in person, and the right wing under General Fraser, was by a circuitous route to concentrate their forces at the head of the middle ravine near the left wing of the Americans, turn that wing, and fall upon the rear of the American camp. At the same time, a strong force composing the left wing and artillery under Generals Phillips and Riedesel were to move along the main road near the margin of the river to within about half a mile of the American lines, and at a given signal, make an attack in front and force their way through. And in order to keep up a perfect understanding between the divisions under Burgoyne and Fraser, and that composing the left wing, 3-minute guns were to be fired at the junction of the former for the latter to advance. Gates learned of the British approach, but he still delayed giving orders to meet the enemy. He finally yielded to Arnold's request to move his forces out to Freeman's Farm to anticipate the British move on the American left flank. Together with Daniel Morgan's riflemen, some of Arnold's light infantry advanced from their defensive position and met Fraser's forces approaching from the west. Burgoyne's center division marched south a half a mile, following the stream forming Wilbur's Basin, then struck off in nearly a southwest direction and through some partial clearings until he arrived a little south of Freeman's Farm. Nielsen described the principal scene of the day's battle as consisting of a cottage with an oblong clearing skirted by an open wood about 60 rods in length from east to west, containing 12 or 15 acres and sloping to the east and south. Meanwhile, General Fraser took a circuitous route along a new road partially opened, leading from the river and intersecting the road from Bemis Heights, north, about 2.5 miles from the American camp, and from this place of intersection, proceeded south towards the American left, until they arrived at some high ground about 150 rods west of Freeman's Cottage. As Fraser's men approached towards the American left, Colonel Morgan, who had been detached to observe the movements of the British and to harass them as they advanced, fell in with the Canadians and Indians in advance of Burgoyne at the middle ravine south of Freeman's Cottage, where he attacked them sharply and drove them back till they were reinforced by a strong corps under Major Forbes about midway between the ravine and cottage, where a brisk engagement took place. But the British were finally driven back to their line, which was then forming, in an open wood in rear of the cottage, where they were again reinforced, and Morgan in turn compelled to retire. It was at this time that Arnold entered the battle with part of Learned's brigade and the New York militia troops, making an attempt to halt Fraser's rapid advance and cut his forces off from the main body under Burgoyne. But, as Nielsen noted, Fraser was, at the same time, endeavoring to execute a similar movement upon him, while neither of them was able, on account of the woods, to perceive the movements of his enemy. The two parties met about 60 rods west of the cottage, on a plain or level piece of ground. Arnold exhibited on this occasion all the impetuosity of his courage. He encouraged his men with voice and example. The action soon became warm, close, and bloody. The enemy, fearing that Arnold, by cutting their line, would penetrate between the right wing and center division, as was manifestly his intention, hastened with 2 regiments of infantry and Bryman's riflemen to reinforce the point attacked, who poured so galling a fire into the right flank of the Americans that, after contesting the ground inch by inch for more than an hour, they finally broke and gave way, when Arnold was compelled to retire and resume his place in the line. As the afternoon went on, more troops from both sides poured into the battle. By 3 o'clock, the British line consisted of the 9th, 21st, 62nd, and 20th regiments of Hamilton's brigade, and Jones' Corps of Grenadiers and Artillery. The American line consisted of 4 regiments under Lieutenant Colonels Brooks, Silly, and Scammell, and Majors Dearborn and Hull. The fighting, in Nielsen's words, became general, and the combatants evinced that ardor and gallantry which showed a determination to conquer or die. The impetuosity of the Americans caused the British troops to begin to leave the field of battle, making it appear that the tide of the battle had turned to the Americans. At that point, however, British General Phillips arrived with artillery and press troops, which stabilized the British line. On the American side, a brigade under General Learned reinforced the line. With both forces steeled for the battle, Nielsen set the scene. The firing, for about 3 hours, was incessant, with continued and tremendous roar and blaze, filling the field with carnage and death. Few battles have been more obstinate and unyielding. At one point the British are overpowered, but being reinforced, the Americans are baffled. These, being supported and renewing their efforts, regain their advantages. The same ground is occupied alternately. The dead and wounded are now promiscuously mingled together. The British resort repeatedly to their bayonets, without effect. The Americans resist and foil their attempts. James Graham, in his biography of Daniel Morgan, further described the ferocity of the battle. About 3 o'clock, the action became general from right to left. At the center, and particularly at the right, where Morgan was posted, it was warm and sanguinary, and along the whole line, the firing did not cease till darkness closed upon the combatants. Again and again had Morgan driven the British troops opposed to him back on the eminence beyond Freeman's clearing. Their cannon had become almost useless from the want of men to serve them. Freed from the advantage which this powerful arm of war afforded his opponents, he made the most desperate efforts to drive them over the hill, and thus turn the left flank of the enemy. But as often was he forced to retire before the great odds which were brought to bear upon him, whenever the advance threatened the accomplishment of his object. The battle raged for upwards of 5 hours, with an obstinacy never before witnessed in America. Victory seemed hovering over the contending armies, undecided, as it were, in whose favor she would declare herself. At one moment, the enemy seemed on the point of achieving a complete triumph, but the next evinced a change in the tide of battle, which rendered their discomfiture apparently inevitable. While one body of Americans, too hardly pressed, might be seen retiring before their immediate adversaries, another might be noticed gallantly driving their opponents before them. The triumphant shouts of friends and enemies were often heard at the same moment, coming from different parts of the field and blending together in a strange and terrible dissonance. The unceasing rattle of musketry, accompanied by the roar of artillery, and the rapid alternations of forward and retrograde movements, left no respite for excitement to subside or courage to cool. While the protraction of the conflict familiarized the men with death, blunted their sense of danger, and rendered them anxious to encounter every peril which promised to lead to a victorious result. The sun was about setting when the American ranks were further reinforced by General Learned and his entire brigade, and one regiment from General Patterson's brigade. A body of German and British troops had been sent from their camp, and were then occupying the right of the British line in a position to outflank the American left. The fresh reinforcement brought these troops to action, but the fire was feeble on both sides and soon ceased altogether. Walworth explained how the battle ended, writing, "While victory seemed thus to sway back and forth over the little stream, which hid its crystal waters under the crimson flood that now crept over it, and while the Americans held the ascendancy, Riedesel came over the field at double quick with his heavy Germans and pressed the exhausted Americans back once more. It was now dark. They gathered up their wounded and prisoners and retired to their camp. The Battle of Freeman's Farm was considered a British victory because they had succeeded in driving the Americans from the field, but it was a Pyrrhic victory at best. The American killed and wounded numbered about 300, but Burgoyne had lost almost 600 killed and wounded, representing nearly 10% of his force. Among the losses were some of his officers, as Nielsen catalogued. Major Jones of the British Artillery had the command of 4 pieces of cannon, which he conducted with great skill and valor till he fell, and 36 out of 48 of his artillerymen were either killed or wounded. His cannon were repeatedly taken and retaken, but finally remained with the enemy for want of horses to bring them off. The 62nd Regiment, under Colonel Anstruther of Hamilton's brigade, was also literally cut to pieces. After the action, it did not exceed 60 men and 5 or 6 officers, fit for duty. The colonel and his major, Harnage, were wounded. During the engagement, a number of the Americans placed themselves in the boughs of high trees, in the rear and flanks, and took every opportunity of destroying the British officers by single shot. And in this way, Captain Green, aide of General Phillips, was shot through the arm, at a moment when he happened to pass between the ball and General Burgoyne, at whom it was aimed. There were also plenty of conspicuous examples of American bravery during the battle, which Nielsen recounted. Lieutenant Colonel Brooks, who with the 8th Massachusetts Regiment was engaged with Bryman's riflemen, remained on the field till about 11 o'clock at night, and was the last who returned. So engaged with the Americans that many of them, after having their wounds dressed, returned again to the fight. Major Hull commanded a detachment of about 200 men who fought with such signal ardor that more than half of them were either killed or wounded. And during the heat of the action, a party of the British having stationed themselves in and near the cottage, from which they were making havoc among his men, detached a band of brave fellows for the purpose, who made a rush, drove them with much slaughter from their position, and took their cannon, and all in less time than it takes to record the fact. Towards the close of the day, General Learned's brigade, and one other regiment, I think Marshall's, were principally engaged on a rise of ground west of the cottage, with the British grenadiers and a regiment of British infantry, and bravely contested the ground till night. After the battle, American forces kept up their harassment of his men, with small bands going out of the American lines to skirmish with the British on a continuous basis. Meanwhile, in a letter to John Hancock, then serving as president of the Continental Congress, Gates reported the victory while inflating his role in the success. "Friday morning I was informed by my reconnoitering parties that the enemy had struck their camp and were removing towards our left. I immediately detached Colonel Morgan's corps, consisting of the Rifle Regiment and the Light Infantry of the Army, to observe their direction and harass their advance. This party, at 12:30, fell in with a picket of the enemy, which they immediately drove. But the enemy being reinforced, after a brisk conflict, they were in turn obliged to retire. This skirmish drew the main body of the enemy and a brigade from my left to support the action, which, after a short cessation, was renewed with great warmth and violence. At this instant, hearing from prisoners that the whole British force and a division of foreigners had engaged our party, I reinforced with 4 more regiments. This continued the action to the close of the day, when both armies retired from the field. Enclosed is a return of our loss, and I am well assured, by the concurrent testimony of prisoners and deserters of various characters, that General Burgoyne, who commanded in person, received a wound in his left shoulder, that the 62nd Regiment was cut to pieces, and that the enemy suffered extremely in every quarter where they were engaged. The general good behavior of file troops on this important occasion cannot be surpassed by the most veteran army. To discriminate in praise of the officers would be injustice, as they all deserve the honor and applause of Congress. Lieutenant Colonel Colburn and Lieutenant Colonel Adams, with the rest of the unfortunate brave who fell in their country's cause, leave a lasting memorial to their glory. The armies remained encamped within 2 miles of each other. The next day, a British deserter arrived in the American camp and reported that Burgoyne's force was preparing to attack the American positions from right to left under the cover of the heavy fog that then shrouded the battlefield. The Americans immediately manned their lines and for more than an hour awaited the assault, which never came. In his memoirs, General James Wilkinson recounted, "We passed an awful hour of expectation and suspense, during which hope, fear, and anxiety played upon the imagination. Many could hear the movement of the enemy, and others could discern through the floating mist the advance of their column. But, between 8 and 9 o'clock, the sun dispersed the vapor, and we had no enemy in view. The report of the deserter was discredited, and the troops dismissed." Subsequently, it was found that the information was correct. Burgoyne had planned on attacking the American left that morning, but his soldiers were so fatigued from the previous fighting that he eventually chose not to do so. Bemis Heights. With Burgoyne's position increasingly imperiled, the Americans could have attacked in force, but Gates resisted Arnold's increasingly vehement suggestions, resulting in a noisy argument in Gates' headquarters. As a further measure of retaliation against Arnold, Gates took command of Daniel Morgan's company to his direct command. Gates informed Morgan in a general order, which stated, "Colonel Morgan's corps, not being attached to any brigade or division of the army, he is to make returns and reports to headquarters only, from whence alone he is to receive orders." James Graham, in his biography of Daniel Morgan, explained Arnold's reaction. A violent altercation immediately ensued between Gates and Arnold. This was followed by a long and acrimonious correspondence, in which Arnold tendered the resignation of his command in the army, and asked permission to go to Philadelphia. Much to his surprise and chagrin, Gates immediately accepted the resignation and granted the required leave. Arnold, fearing the consequences to his reputation which might follow his desertion of the army at so critical a period of the campaign, soon after made some advances toward reconciling the difficulty, in the hope of being reinstated in his command. It was, however, all in vain. The command of the left wing was assumed by Gates himself, and that of the right conferred upon General Lincoln, who arrived in camp with a body of militia from the eastern states while the quarrel was pending. Why exactly Gates had such a negative view of Arnold is still a subject of speculation. Colonel Richard Barrick, at the time secretary to General Philip Schuyler, wrote Schuyler concerning the argument between Arnold and Gates. "He seems to be piqued that Arnold's division had the honor of beating the enemy on the 19th. This I am certain of, that Arnold has all the credit of the action." After the campaign ended, Barrick wrote that Burgoyne himself gave Arnold great credit for his bravery and military abilities, especially in the action of the 19th, whenever he spoke of him, and once in the presence of General Gates. In the end, Arnold requested leave to transfer to Washington's command, which Gates granted, but for reasons that are not entirely clear, Arnold remained in camp during this time. In the meantime, the British and American forces remained opposite each other from September 20th to October 7th without barely moving camp. Walworth wrote of this time, "Our army was exultant, hopeful, scarcely to be checked in its rest, less desire to drive the invader from the fruitful fields and deserted homes he desecrated and destroyed. Rushing out from their entrenchments, under every plausible excuse to skirmish with the outposts of the enemy, or capture his pickets, The eager militia could with difficulty be restrained by the cautious Gates from bringing on the general engagement that he seemed quite willing to avoid. The other camp seemed oppressed by the overhanging cloud of its impending fate. The British officers, perpetually on the alert, were unable to secure a single night of undisturbed repose. The men bore with quiet but sullen fortitude the privations and hardships of short rations, hurried snatches of sleep under full accoutrements, and constant calls to arms. More and more vivid to all grew the vision of that impassable wall of difficulties that enclosed them on all sides, leaving but one narrow pathway to the north. That said, both sides were active during this pause. Nielsen noted that Burgoyne threw up a line of entrenchments with batteries across the plain to the river hills, also an entrenchment with batteries across the defile at the northern extremity of the flats and extending to the river on his left, the whole being about 2 miles in extent. An English regiment, the Hessians of Hanau, and a detachment of Loyalists were encamped on the flats, where he had established his magazines and hospitals for greater security. At the same time, according to Nielsen, the Americans constructed extensive fortifications across their part of the front. They now extended and completed their line of breastworks from the northeastern angle on the river hills west across the farm then owned by the late John Nielsen Esquire, deceased, about 3/4 of a mile, to the heights on the left, and to within a few rods of his dwelling house now occupied by his son, the present writer. From the heights on the left, and a few rods north of the dwelling house, the entrenchments extended south and southwest, about 3/4 of a mile, to a great ravine. At the northwest angle stood a large log barn, which was strengthened by a double tier of logs on three sides, and strong batteries, in circular form, extending from each extremity, south about 150 feet, and encircled by a deep trench and palisades or pickets. The whole area within the circle of the pickets was near half an acre, and out of respect to the owner, who was a very active Whig, it was honored with the name of Fort Nielsen. A little left of the center, between the northern extremities, was a strong battery, and also about 50 rods south of the fort was another. And in the rear, near the center of the encampment, was their magazine, which was also fortified. Much of these fortifications are still existing, sufficient to plainly trace their line and the positions of the several batteries. The front of the camp was covered from the right to the left by a deep ravine, running nearly parallel with the line, and a great part of the way by a dense forest. From a little left of the fort, and for some distance west, large trees were felled in every direction, which presented an almost insurmountable barrier. Unbeknownst to Burgoyne, his route back to Canada had been cut off when American forces under General Lincoln and Colonel John Brown attacked the British at Ticonderoga. While unable to reduce the fort itself, the Americans did succeed in recapturing Skenesborough and Ticonderoga's outer defenses. Given Burgoyne's persistence in pressing the attack, it's doubtful that he would have abandoned his advance and retreated back to Canada, even had he known about those developments. All the while, he continued to hope for assistance from British forces to his south. He received a letter from General Sir Henry Clinton in New York on September 21st that offered the hope of such assistance in the form of a movement up the Hudson River to draw up Gates' army. Clinton told Burgoyne that he would attack the forts below the highlands and attempt to move north. Burgoyne immediately dispatched 2 officers in disguise back to Clinton with a message describing the desperate state of his army and urging him to make haste. Furthermore, Burgoyne assured him that he would continue to hold his position until October 12th. As fate would have it, Clinton would actually begin moving forces that way and take some forts in the vicinity in early October. But his messengers announcing that to Burgoyne were captured. Thus, as the days passed without word from Clinton, and with the situation of his army becoming increasingly dire, Burgoyne decided he could not wait much longer for assistance from the south. Burgoyne would later make the following claim in the House of Commons as part of his defense of his actions in the campaign. On the second day after the action, I received intelligence from Sir Henry Clinton of his intention to attack the Highlands about that time, and I was hourly in expectation, I thought a justly founded one, of that measure operating to dislodge Mr. Gates entirely, or to oblige him to detach a large portion of his force. Either of these cases would probably have opened my way to Albany. In these circumstances, could the preference upon these alternatives admit of a moment's reflection? To wait so fair a prospect of effecting at last the great purpose of the campaign, or to put a victorious army, under all the disadvantages of a beaten one, by a difficult and disgraceful retreat, relinquishing the long-expected cooperation in the very hour of its promise, and leaving Sir Henry Clinton's army, and probably Sir William Howe's, exposed, with so much of the season of the campaign to run, to the whole force of Mr. Gates, after he should have seen me on the other side of Hudson's River. Perhaps not surprisingly, Burgoyne reached the following conclusion. Upon mature consideration of these and other circumstances attending this period, come to my knowledge since, I am clearly of opinion that had the reinforcements from England arrived in time, to have enabled Sir Henry Clinton to have effected the stroke he afterwards so gallantly made in the Highlands, any time between the two actions, I should have made my way. Nielsen described the dispositions of both sides at this point. General Gates, having given up the command of the right wing to General Lincoln, assumed that of the left, and moved his headquarters from Bemis House near the river, to a house standing about 100 rods south of the fort, and owned by Captain Ephraim Woodworth, the left being composed of 2 brigades under Generals Poor and Learned, Colonel Morgan's Rifle Corps, and a part of the New England Militia, Colonel Morgan occupying the heights immediately south of the fort, General Learned's brigade, the plain below or on the east, and General Poor's brigade, the heights south of Morgan, and between him and General Gates' headquarters. The British troops were disposed in the following order. The Hessians under Colonel Bryman occupied the extreme right, or right flank defense. The light infantry, under Lord Balcarres and Fraser's elite, that part of the camp around Freeman's Cottage, flanked by the Grenadiers and Hamilton's brigade, on their left, and extending to the North Branch Ravine. The remainder of the army, including Riedesel's command, occupied the plain and the ground north of Wilbur's Basin to protect their magazine and hospital. Burgoyne ultimately decided to take action on October 7th, unaware that the American ranks had since swelled to nearly 15,000 men. Walworth noted, as Burgoyne's situation became day by day more critical, and he received no news from Clinton, on the 4th of October he called Generals Riedesel, Phillips, and Fraser together in council. Riedesel was strongly in favor of a retreat to Fort Edward, and Fraser conceded the wisdom of such a movement. Phillips declined to express an opinion, and Burgoyne finally declared that on the 7th he would make a reconnaissance, and if he then found the enemy too strong to be attacked, he would immediately retreat to Fort Edward and await the cooperation of the army below. On the 6th, he had 5 days' rations distributed and arranged for a reconnaissance in force on the following day. As he could not leave his camp unprotected, he only took 1,500 men. They were selected from the corps of Riedesel, Fraser, and Phillips. Led by these officers in person and Burgoyne as commander-in-chief, they marched out of camp at 11 o'clock on the morning of the 7th, and entered a field within 3/4 of a mile of the American left. Here, in double ranks, they formed in line of battle. On the left, Williams' artillery and Ackland's grenadiers were posted, on a gentle hill in the edge of a wood that fronted on Mill Creek. Balcarres' light infantry and other English regiments formed the right. The Hessians held the center. Fraser, with 500 picked men, was posted to the right in front of Balcarres, where a hill skirted the meadow. He was ready to fall upon the rear of the American left at the first attack in front. Unfortunately for Burgoyne's plan, the Americans soon divined the British intention to attack the left. Gates soon received word from deserters and the local inhabitants that the British were preparing an attack. Nielsen wrote, accordingly, General Fellows, with about 1,500 men, was detached across the river, and to take post on the heights opposite the Saratoga Ford to watch their movements and prevent their passage at that place. Now on high alert, the Americans became sensitive to any perceived movement by the British. For example, Nielsen explained, "In the afternoon of the 6th, an unusual movement was perceived in the British camp, and especially in that part of it which extended across the plain near the river, which, at that time, induced a belief that the army were about to attempt a retreat during the following night. Consequently, General Gates augmented his forces near the river by drawing off a portion of those on the heights preparatory to a close pursuit, should that be the case. But it afterwards appeared that Burgoyne was only arranging his troops, preparatory to such subsequent course as might be determined upon the next day." The next day, Burgoyne made his move. On the 7th of October, between 10 and 11 o'clock, Burgoyne, having committed the guard of his camp upon the high ground, near Freeman's Cottage, to the Brigadier Generals Hamilton and Specht, and that of the redoubts and plain near the river, to Brigadier General Gall, began to move with about 1,500 men to the northern extremity of a low ridge of land, about 3/4 of a mile, and a little north of west, from the American camp, where they displayed, formed the line, and sat down in double ranks. On October 8th, Gates sent soldiers into a field to forage for wheat, and these men spotted British officers with field glasses surveying the American positions. Nielsen explained, "General Gates, having received information of their movements, dispatched one of his aides to ascertain their position, and if possible their intentions. He proceeded about 1/2 mile to a small rise of ground, near Asa Chatfield's house, where he discovered them, about 60 rods in advance, in a wheat field, and foragers in the act of cutting the wheat or standing straw, and several officers mounted on the top of a cabin, Joseph Munger's, from whence, with their glasses, they were endeavoring to reconnoiter the American left, which was concealed from their view by intervening woods. A party of Canadians and savages that were scouring the woods on the flank of the British Grenadiers as they were marching from camp fell in with and attacked the American pickets, near the middle ravine, which were driven in and followed by the Grenadiers to within musket shot distance of Gates' line of entrenchments, where a tremendous discharge of cannon and musketry took place, which was returned with equal intrepidity by the Americans. For about 30 minutes, the action at the breastworks, a little south of the fort, was maintained with great obstinacy on both sides. The initial skirmishes started by these maneuvers began to develop over time into a more general battle, and by 2 o'clock, the British line of battle was fully formed. Nielsen noted, "Their grenadiers, under Major Ackland, and their artillery under Major Williams, occupied a rise of ground on the left, bordering on a wood and covered in front by the head of the middle ravine. Their light infantry under Lord Balcarres, in a southwestern direction, and on their extreme right, and covered by a rail fence, and the center was composed of British and German battalions under Generals Phillips and Riedesel. In advance of the right wing, and near J. Munger's, as before mentioned, were stationed about 1,000 men under General Fraser, 500 having been withdrawn, intended to fall on the Americans in flank and rear, while the attack should be made in front." When this activity was reported back to Gates, he said in response, "Order out Morgan to begin the game." Gates directed Morgan to take his rifle corps of 1,500 men by a circuitous route through the woods to meet the British on the flank of their advancing right, and to attack when the Americans began to fire on the British left. Nielsen explained, "It was concerted that time should be allowed Colonel Morgan to make the proposed circuits and gain his station on the enemy's right before the attack should be made on the left. General Poor's brigade, composed of the New York and New Hampshire troops, to be supported by a part of Learned's brigade, was ordered for this service, and the attack was commenced at about 2:30 on the front and flank of the British Grenadiers." Nielsen described the fighting on the British left. "When General Poor had drawn up his men in order of battle, and given them orders not to fire until they commenced rising the hill, There was, for a moment, an awful pause. Each party seemed to bid defiance to his opponent. At length, however, the grenadiers commenced the action by a shower of grape shot and musket balls, which took no other effect than to mar the trees above the heads of the Americans, who, the din of the battle now begun, rushed on firing and opening to the right and left, and forming again on the flanks, mowing down the grenadiers at every shot, until they gained the top of the hill, where a close and bloody conflict ensued, which lasted, with tremendous roar and blaze of artillery and small arms, for about 30 minutes, when the commander of the grenadiers, Major Ackland, was badly wounded, being shot through both legs, and the grenadiers being too vigorously pressed, broke and gave way, leaving the ground thickly strewed with their dead and dying. In this dreadful struggle, one field piece was taken and retaken 5 times, and finally fell into the hands of the Americans, upon which Colonel Silly, of New Hampshire, exulting in its capture, immediately mounted, and it being sworn true to America, was turned and fired on the British troops, with their own ammunition, which was left in the boxes. While Poor attacked the grenadiers, some of his forces discovered a flanking party of British advancing through the woods. Poor ordered Colonel Silly's regiment to intercept them. As he approached near to a brush fence, Nielsen writes, the British troops rose from behind it, and immediately fired, but done it so hurriedly that only a few balls took effect. The commander of the British then ordered his men to fix bayonets and charge the damned rebels. Colonel Silly, who heard the order, responded, it takes two to play at that game. Charge, and we will try it. The Americans charged at the word, and rushing upon the enemy, discharged a volley in their faces, when they immediately broke and fled, leaving many of their number dead and wounded on the field. With the fighting having commenced on the British left, Morgan's corps entered the battle on the British right. Nielsen described how his men poured down unexpectedly upon the British right advance, and after a sharp contest, drove them in with much slaughter. Then by a sudden movement to his left, he fell upon the flank of the British right, with such impetuosity, and with a so well-directed fire, that they soon fell into confusion, and while attempting to change their front, Major Dearborn, who at that critical moment had arrived on the field with 2 regiments of New England troops, poured so galling a fire into their flank and rear that they soon broke, and were compelled to retire. They were, however, again rallied and reformed by the Earl of Balcarres, behind a fence in rear of their first position. But being again attacked in front and flank, with so great vigor by superior numbers, that resistance became vain, and the whole right wing gave way. At this point, aside from giving those orders to Morgan's riflemen, Gates was still reluctant to commit a larger force, despite knowing full well that his forces had a clear numerical superiority over Burgoyne's. This was the last straw for Arnold, who protested that the force he had thus far committed was clearly insufficient and pressed Gates to send a larger force. Gates had finally had enough of Arnold, yelling at him, "You have no business here." Gates dismissed Arnold, but he also sent a brigade led by Brigadier General Enoch Poor to support Morgan's assault on the British left, while Brigadier General Ebenezer Learned held the center of the left facing Burgoyne's German troops. An eyewitness to the battle wrote about the initial action years later, recalling, the advance parties of the 2 armies came into contact about 3 o'clock on Tuesday afternoon. The Americans soon approached the Royal Army, and each party, in defiance, awaited the deadly blow. The gallant Colonel Morgan, at the head of his famous rifle corps, and Major Dearborn, leading a detachment of infantry, commenced the action, and rushed courageously on the British grenadiers, commanded by Major Ackland, and the furious attack was most firmly resisted. In all parts of the field, the conflict became extremely arduous and obstinate, an unconquerable spirit on each side disdaining to yield the palm of victory. Death appeared to have lost his terrors. Breaches in the ranks were no sooner made than supplied by fresh combatants, awaiting a similar fate. While Morgan and Poor were succeeding in turning the British right, the Germans held their ground in the center of the Americans' left. Nielsen explained, At length, the Americans pressed forward with renewed strength and ardor, and compelled the whole British line, commanded by Burgoyne himself, to yield to their deadly fire, and they retreat in disorder. The German troops remained firmly posted at their lines. These were now boldly assaulted by Brigadier General Learned and Lieutenant Colonel Brooks at the head of their respective commands, with such intrepidity that the works were carried, and their brave commander, Lieutenant Colonel Bremen, was slain. The Germans were pursued to their encampments, which, with all the equipage of the brigade, fell into our hands. Colonel Silly, of General Poor's brigade, having acquitted himself honorably, was seen astride on a brass field piece, exulting in the capture. Major Hull, of the Massachusetts line, was among those who so bravely stormed the enemy's entrenchment, and acted a conspicuous part. It was at this point that Benedict Arnold appeared seemingly out of nowhere, so feverishly excited that many believed he was drunk. Arnold began personally rallying Learned's forces and drove them at the Germans' positions. Walworth described the scene. At this moment, Arnold, excited into frenzy by the clash and roar of the battle, dashed like a meteor on the field, followed in the distance by Armstrong, Gates' aide-de-camp, carrying orders to compel his return. Stop the bison on his native plain? The swallow on its flight? More easy this than Armstrong's task. The genius of war thrilled Arnold's soul, as epic meters stir the poet, as rugged landscapes, shadowed under sunset lights, influence the artist's brain. Genius ever lives and conquers. It may be desecrated and destroyed, as Arnold buried his in ignominy. But while it lives and inspires its own peculiar work, it rules and is supreme. Men bow before it, or lie crushed beneath its power. Thus, when Arnold waved his sword and shouted his brief commands, the genius within him rung through the tones of his voice, glanced from the quivering flash of his saber, and the regiments followed where he led. One strong will, one palpitating force. With two brigades, he rushed upon the Hessian center, who stood the shock bravely for a time. But as he dashed upon them again and again with a fury they had never witnessed, they turned and fled in dismay. When General Fraser was mortally wounded during this part of the fighting, Burgoyne took command of the British forces personally, seeking to rally his shattered forces and stem the American advance. Walworth explained. Burgoyne was seen in the thickest of the melee, under the heaviest fire. Several shots tore his clothing, and his aides implored him not to expose himself, but resolute and daring, he endeavored skillfully, but vainly, to rally his army and hold his ground. He could more easily have checked a hurricane on the great prairies. His whole force was driven before the storm and swept into their entrenched camp. Here they made a determined stand. Arnold now took Patterson's brigade and assailed Fraser's camp, where Balcarres and his light infantry had taken refuge. Charging with renewed vigor again and again up the embankment, he led the way over a strong abattis. Driven back from this, he attacked the entrenchments connecting this redoubt with Bremen's flank defense. Here he succeeded, and leaving the Massachusetts regiments to follow up the advantage at that point, he encountered a part of Learned's brigade and dashed upon the strong works of the Hessian camp. Here, too, he drove everything before him. Capturing the cannon, the artillerists fled in consternation, and Bremen was killed on the spot. Arnold's horse was shot under him, it fell on him, and his leg was severely wounded. He was carried from the field. The whole British camp now lay exposed to the pursuing Americans. Night and silence fell upon the scene. The groans of the wounded, the muffled words of command given for the burial of the dead, and the dirge-like wailing of the autumn wind in the tall pines were the only sounds that followed the roar of artillery and the shouts of the victors. On the British right flank, the action continued past sunset. Nielsen explained. This right flank defense of the enemy, occupied by the German corps under Colonel Bremen, consisted in a great measure of a breastwork of rails piled horizontally between perpendicular pickets, driven into the earth, impotent to the rest of his line, and extended about 200 yards across an open field. and was covered on the high ground on the right by a battery of two guns. The interval from the left of this defense to the light infantry, under Lord Balcarres, was committed to the defense of the provincialists, who occupied a log house and barn then owned by Thomas Leggett. The Germans were encamped immediately behind the rail breastwork, and the ground in front of it declined in a very gentle slope for about 120 yards when it sunk abruptly. The American troops had formed a line under this declivity and covered breast high, were warmly engaged with the Germans. From this position, about sunset, Brigadier General Lernen advanced towards the enemy with his brigade in open column, with Colonel Jackson's regiment, then in command of Lieutenant Colonel Brooks, in front. On his approach, he inquired where he could put in with most advantage. A slack fire was observed at an opening between the left of the Germans and light infantry, occupied by the provincialists, and the general was recommended to incline to the right and attack that point. He did so with great gallantry. The provincialists abandoned their position and fled. The German flank, by this means being left uncovered, and Arnold arriving at the moment and taking the lead of Lernet's brigade, they were vigorously assaulted, overturned in a few minutes, and retreated in great disorder, leaving their gallant commander mortally wounded on the field, and all their tents, artillery, and baggage in possession of the victors. By dislodging this corps, the whole British encampment was laid open to the Americans. But the extreme darkness of the night, the fatigue of the men, and disorder incident to undisciplined troops, after so desultory an action, put it out of the power of the Americans to improve the advantages. By the time night fell and the fighting ended, Burgoyne's plan for crushing the American rebellion, so carefully laid out for King George III in London just a few months before, lay in ruins on a wilderness battlefield in Upper New York. Bemis Heights had cost him nearly 900 men killed, wounded, and captured, while American casualties are estimated at around 150. Among the British dead was General Fraser, who lived a few more hours. Returned to the British camp, and informed by the surgeon that he only had a short time to live, Fraser is said to have cried, "Oh, fatal ambition! Poor General Burgoyne! My poor wife!" On the other side, the Americans were fully aware of the extent of their victory. The writer for Thatcher's Military Journal exclaimed, "Nightfall put a stop to our brilliant career, though the victory was most decisive, and it is with pride and exultation that we recount the triumph of American bravery. Besides Lieutenant Colonel Breyman slain, General Fraser, one of the most valuable officers in the British service, was mortally wounded, and survived but a few hours. Fraser was the soul of the British Army, and was just changing the disposition of a part of the troops to repel a strong impression which the Americans had made, and were still making, on the British right, when Morgan called together two or three of his best marksmen, and pointing to Fraser, said, 'Do you see that gallant officer? That is General Fraser. I respect and honor him, but it is necessary he should die.' This was enough. Fraser immediately received his mortal wound, and was carried off the field. Sir Francis Clark, aide-de-camp to General Burgoyne, was brought into our camp with a mortal wound, and Major Ackland, who commanded the British Grenadiers, was wounded through both legs, and is our prisoner. Several other officers, and about 200 privates, are prisoners in our hands, with 9 pieces of cannon and a considerable supply of ammunition, which was much wanted for our troops." Under the cover of darkness, the Americans laid in wait about half a mile from the British lines, with the intention of renewing the attack in the morning. Around midnight, Lincoln's division arrived to relieve the troops and occupy the ground won through their exertions. By then, however, Burgoyne was in the process of pulling his men back from the field to positions on the river bank, and on October 8th, heavy skirmishing occurred as the British retrieved and buried their dead. According to one historian of the campaign, John Jenkins, Burgoyne made some ineffectual attempts to provoke General Gates to attack him in his strong position, but the latter prudently declined to unequal a contest, and employed himself in taking every precaution to prevent the escape of the opposing force. He posted 1,400 men on the heights opposite the port of Saratoga and sent detachments to the other fords higher up the river. A brisk cannonading was kept up during the 8th, and considerable skirmishing took place. At 9 o'clock that evening, Burgoyne ordered his army to retreat, leaving the baggage and wounded behind. Later, however, in a driving rainstorm at Dobegat, he ordered his men to halt. Walworth noted, "The imperious commander, who had led the forward march with unflinching resolution, pushing to his end without fear or hesitation, when foiled and sent back, for a moment shuddered, and refused to accept his fate. He still held his panic-stricken army under his will, and he determined once more to wait for the coming of the army from below. It might yet bring him relief." The Surrender. Over the next 2 days, Burgoyne marched his tired and beleaguered army to Saratoga, arriving there on October 11th. Gates followed Burgoyne, reaching Saratoga shortly after, and encamping on the south side of the Fishkill River. Morgan's troops were posted on the heights near Saratoga Lake, in the rear and flank of the British camp. Burgoyne's forces were surrounded. Walworth wrote that the British now realized their camp was exposed in every part to the fire of cannon or riflemen. No approach to the river was permitted, and there was much suffering for want of water. The sick, wounded, and women were huddled together in a house where cannonballs tore through the walls and rolled across the floor, often wounding the helpless men who lay within. Madame Riedesel, with her children, and the other ladies took refuge in a cellar, where hours of horror were endured with uncomplaining misery. As Burgoyne found himself trapped, General Clinton was advancing up the Hudson towards Burgoyne's positions. After capturing Fort Montgomery and Fort Clinton, the British destroyed the obstructions the Americans had placed across the river to impede a British advance by water, and they burned some American vessels. American forces retreated from the area, leaving the way to Albany undefeated. But at this point, Clinton retreated after burning Kingston, leaving Burgoyne to fend for himself. With only a few days of rations remaining, Burgoyne called his officers together on October 12th. The minutes of this conference reveal the few options remaining to the British, as presented by Burgoyne to his generals. The enemy in force, according to the best intelligence he could obtain, to the amount of upwards of 14,000 men, and a considerable quantity of artillery, are on this side the Fishkill, and threaten an attack. On the other side the Hudson's River, between this army and Fort Edward, is another army of the enemy, the numbers unknown, but one corps, which there has been an opportunity of observing, is reported to be about 1,500 men. They have likewise cannon on the other side of the Hudson's River, and they have a bridge below Saratoga Church, by which the two armies can communicate. The bateaux of the army have been destroyed, and no means appear of making a bridge over the Hudson's River, were it even practicable from the position of the enemy. The only means of retreat, therefore, are by the ford at Fort Edward, or taking the mountains in order to pass the river higher up by rafts, or by any other ford, which is reported to be practicable with difficulty, or by keeping the mountains to pass the head of Hudson's River, and continue to the westward of Lake George all the way to Ticonderoga. It is true, this last passage was never made but by Indians, or very small bodies of men. In order to pass cannon or any wheel carriages from hence to Fort Edward, some bridges must be repaired under fire of the enemy from the opposite side of the river, and the principal bridge will be a work of 14 or 15 hours. There is no good position for the army to take to sustain that work, and if there were, the time stated as necessary would give the enemy on the other side the Hudson's River an opportunity to take post on the strong ground above Fort Edward, or to dispute the ford while General Gates' army followed in the rear. The intelligence from the lower part of Hudson's River is founded upon the concurrent reports of prisoners and deserters, who say it was the news in the enemy's camp that Fort Montgomery was taken, and one man, a friend to government, who arrived yesterday, mentions some particulars of the manner in which it was taken. The provisions of the army may hold out to the 20th. There is neither rum nor spruce beer. Burgoyne then asked his officers for input on the possible courses of action. First, to wait in the present position and attack from the enemy, or the chance of favorable events. Second, to attack the enemy. Third, to retreat repairing the bridges as the army moves for the artillery, in order to force the passage of the ford. Fourth, to retreat by night, leaving the artillery and the baggage, and should it be found impracticable to force the passage with musketry, to attempt the upper ford, or the passage round Lake George, in case the enemy, by extending to their left, leave their rear open to march rapidly for Albany. Burgoyne and his generals evaluated each option and came to the reluctant conclusion that only one was viable. Upon the first proposition resolved, that the situation would grow worse by delay, that the provision now in store not more than sufficient for the retreat, should impediments intervene, or a circuit of country become necessary. And as the enemy did not attack when the ground was unfortified, it is not probable they will do it now, as they have a better game to play. The second unadvisable and desperate, there being no possibility of reconnoitering the enemy's position, and his great superiority of numbers known. The third impracticable. The fifth thought worthy of consideration by the Lieutenant General, Major General Phillips, and Brigadier General Hamilton. But the position of the enemy yet gives no opening for it. Resolved that the fourth proposition is the only resource, and that to effect it, the utmost secrecy and silence is to be observed, and the troops are to be put in motion from the right in the still part of the night, without any change in the disposition. It depended upon the delivery of 6 days' provision in due time, and upon the return of scouts, who had been sent forward to examine by what route the army could probably move the first 4 miles undiscovered, whether the plan should take place on that day or on the morrow. The scouts on their return reported that the enemy's position on the right was such, and they had so many small parties out, that it would be impossible to move without our march being immediately discovered. The next day, Burgoyne called his officers together again, and as the minutes of the Second Council of War recorded, all agreed there were no options left for the British. The Lieutenant General, having explained the situation of affairs, as in the preceding council, with the additional intelligence that the enemy was entrenched at the fords of Fort Edward, and likewise occupied the strong position on the Pine Plains between Fort George and Fort Edward, expressed his readiness to undertake at their head any enterprise of difficulty or hazard that should appear to them within the compass of their strength of spirit. He added that he had reason to believe a capitulation had been in the contemplation of some, perhaps of all, who knew the real situation of things, that upon a circumstance of such consequence to national and personal honor, he thought it a duty to his country, and to himself, to extend his counsel beyond the usual limits, that the assembly present might justly be esteemed a full representation of the army, and that he should think himself unjustifiable in taking any step in so serious a matter, without such a concurrence of sentiments as should make a treaty the act of the army, as well as that of the general. The first question, therefore, he desired them to decide was whether an army of 3,500 fighting men and well provided with artillery were justifiable, upon the principles of national dignity and military honor, in capitulating any possible situation. Resolved in the affirmative. Question 2. Is the present situation of that nature? Resolved that the present situation justifies a capitulation upon honorable terms. Burgoyne drew up a message for Gates and, once approved by the council, had it delivered to the American general by a Major Kingston on October 14th. After having fought you twice, Lieutenant General Burgoyne has waited some days, in his present position, determined to try a third conflict against any force you could bring to attack him. He is apprised of the superiority of your numbers and the disposition of your troops to impede his supplies, and render his retreat a scene of carnage on both sides. In this situation, he is impelled by humanity and thinks himself justifiable by established principles and precedents of state and of war to spare the lives of brave men upon honorable terms. Should Major General Gates be inclined to treat upon that idea, General Burgoyne would propose a cessation of arms during the time necessary to communicate the preliminary terms by which, in any extremity, he and his army mean to abide. Later that day, Kingston returned to Burgoyne's headquarters with Gates' proposed terms. In a published defense of his actions during the campaign, Burgoyne reproduced the terms along with his answers. I, General Burgoyne's army, being exceedingly reduced by repeated defeats, by desertion, sickness, their provisions exhausted, their military horses, tents, and baggage taken or destroyed, their retreat cut off, and their camp invested, they can only be allowed to surrender prisoners of war. Answer: Lieutenant General Burgoyne's army, however reduced, will never admit that their retreat is cut off while they have arms in their hands. 2. The officers and soldiers may keep the baggage belonging to them. The generals of the United States never permit individuals to be pillaged. 3. The troops under His Excellency General Burgoyne will be conducted by the most convenient route to New England, marching by easy marches and sufficiently provided for by the way. Answer: This article is answered by General Burgoyne's first proposal, which is here annexed. 4. The officers will be admitted on parole, may wear their sidearms, and will be treated with the liberality customary in Europe, so long as they, by proper behavior, continue to deserve it. But those who are apprehended having broke their parole, as some British officers have done, must expect to be close confined. Answer: There being no officer in this army under, or capable of being under, the description of breaking parole, this article needs no answer. 5. All public stores, artillery, arms, ammunition, carriages, horses, must be delivered to commissaries appointed to receive them. Answer: All public stores may be delivered, arms excepted. 6. These terms being agreed to and signed, the troops under His Excellency General Burgoyne's command may be drawn up in their encampments, where they will be ordered to ground their arms, and may thereupon be marched to the riverside, to be passed over in their way towards Bennington. Answer: This article inadmissible in any extremity. Sooner than this army will consent to ground their arms in their encampments, they will rush on the enemy, determined to take no quarter. 7. A cessation of arms to continue till sunset, to receive General Burgoyne's answer. At this point, however, both Gates and Burgoyne received word of Clinton's assault up the Hudson. His fears aroused, Gates sent a message to Burgoyne, agreeing to the British general's terms. Burgoyne agreed, and American and British officers set about negotiating some of the minor details of the surrender. But when Burgoyne learned of Clinton's advance, he hurriedly called his officers together and asked if they could honorably withdraw their surrender and await Clinton's forces. To a man, Burgoyne's officers advised that such a move would be dishonorable. According to the minutes, General Gates having, in answer to General Burgoyne's message, given a solemn affirmation on his honor that no detachment has been made from his army during the negotiation of the treaty, is the treaty, in its present situation, binding on this army, or is the general's honor engaged for the signing it? The lieutenant general's opinion being clear that he is not bound by what has passed, he would not execute the treaty upon the sole consideration of the point of honor, notwithstanding the respectable majority against him. He is likewise far from being convinced that this army, by great exertions and by great enduring in point of provisions, might not yet be relieved, but he is compelled to yield on the following considerations. The treaty was generally thought a most advantageous one before the intelligence arrived. That intelligence is refuted, and ocular demonstration of its falsity pledged as far as relates to General Gates' force, The other parts are only founded on hearsay and not to be depended upon. Should General Clinton be where reported, yet the distance is such as to render any relief from him improbable during the time our provisions could be made to last, declares his post untenable, and says, if this convention is not signed, he apprehends there will be considerable desertion. Says he thinks the 47th Regiment not to be depended on. Is of the same opinion. Thinks the 62nd Regiment is disheartened by the situation of their post, and not equal to their former exertions. Several officers think the men in general seem to have got the convention in their heads as desirable. Many of the best officers are absent by sickness and wounds from all the corps. Though the other officers at the head of the British Corps think they can answer for the spirit of their men, if attacked on their present ground, it is evident the most sanguine do not think any part of the army in that elevation and alacrity of spirit necessary for undertaking desperate enterprises. To break up the treaty now renders a future renewal of it hopeless, as our condition must every hour grow worse. A defeat is fatal to the army. A victory does not save it, as they have neither provisions to advance nor retreat against an enemy who, by experience we know, are capable of rallying at every advantageous post. And that the life and property of every provincial independent of this army depends upon the execution of this treaty. Thus, on October 17th, Burgoyne and Gates signed the Articles of Convention that surrendered the entire British Army to the Americans. The articles read, 1. The troops under Lieutenant General Burgoyne, to march out of their camp with the honors of war and the artillery of the entrenchments, to the verge of the river where the old fort stood, where the arms and artillery are to be left, the arms to be piled by word of command from their own officers. 2. A free passage to be granted to the army under Lieutenant General Burgoyne to Great Britain, on condition of not serving again in North America during the present contest, and the port of Boston is assigned for the entry of transports to receive the troops, whenever General Howe shall so order. 3. Should any cartel take place, by which the army under General Burgoyne, or any part of it, may be exchanged, the foregoing article to be void as far as such exchange shall be made. 4. The army under Lieutenant General Burgoyne to march to Massachusetts Bay by the easiest, most expeditious, and convenient route, and to be quartered in, near, or as convenient as possible to Boston, that the march of the troops may not be delayed when transports arrive to receive them. 5. The troops to be supplied on their march, and during their being in quarters, with provisions, by General Gates' orders, at the same rate of rations as the troops of his own army, and if possible the officers' horses and cattle, are to be supplied with forage at the usual rates. 6. All officers to retain their carriages, bat horses, and other cattle, and no baggage to be molested or searched, Lieutenant General Burgoyne giving his honor that there are no public stores secreted therein. Major General Gates will, of course, take the necessary measures for the due performance of this article. Should any carriages be wanted during the march for the transportation of officers' baggage, they are, if possible, to be supplied by the country at the usual rates. 7. Upon the march, and during the time the army shall remain in quarters in Massachusetts Bay, the officers are not, as far as circumstances will admit, to be separated from their men. The officers are to be quartered according to rank, and are not to be hindered from assembling their men for roll call and other necessary purposes of regularity. 8. All corps whatever of General Burgoyne's army, whether composed of sailors, battlemen, artificers, drivers, independent companies, and followers of the army, of whatever country, shall be included in the fullest sense and utmost extent of the above articles, and comprehended in every respect as British subjects. 9. All Canadians, and persons belonging to the Canadian establishment, consisting of sailors, battlemen, artificers, drivers, independent companies, and many other followers of the army, who come under no particular description, are to be permitted to return there. They are to be conducted immediately by the shortest route to the first British port on Lake George, are to be supplied with provisions in the same manner as other troops, and are to be bound by the same condition of not serving during the present contest in North America. 10. Passports to be immediately granted for 3 officers, not exceeding the rank of captain, who shall be appointed by Lieutenant General Burgoyne, to carry dispatches to Sir William Howe, Sir Guy Carleton, and to Great Britain, by the way of New York, and Major General Gates engages the public faith that these dispatches shall not be opened. These officers are to set out immediately after receiving their dispatches, and are to travel the shortest route and in the most expeditious manner. 11. During the stay of the troops in Massachusetts Bay, the officers are to be admitted on parole, and are to be allowed to wear their sidearms. 12. Should the Army under Lieutenant General Burgoyne find it necessary to send for their clothing and other baggage to Canada, they are to be permitted to do it in the most convenient manner, and the necessary passports granted for that purpose. 13. These articles are to be mutually signed and exchanged tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock, and the troops under Lieutenant General Burgoyne are to march out of their entrenchments at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Walworth described the scene of the final surrender of the British Army, the worst defeat suffered by the British up to that point in their history. The British Army were now marched out of their camps, under their own officers, to a plain near Old Port Hardy, where the Fishkill empties into the Hudson. Here, in the presence of only one American, an aide-de-camp of Gates, they laid down their arms. Generals Burgoyne, Reedus, and Phillips now passed over the Fishkill to the headquarters of Gates, who rode out to meet them, accompanied by his aides. When they met, Burgoyne said, "The fortunes of war, General, have made me your prisoner," to which Gates replied, "I shall ever be ready to bear testimony that it has not been through any fault of your excellency." The American army were drawn up in ranks on either side of the road. The whole army of British prisoners, preceded by a guard bearing the stars and stripes and a band playing Yankee Doodle, were marched between the files of their victors. Gates and Burgoyne stood contemplating the scene. In the presence of both armies, General Burgoyne stepped out, and drawing his sword from its scabbard, presented it to General Gates. He received it and silently returned it to the vanquished general. In the aftermath of the surrender, British forces withdrew from Ticonderoga and Crown Point in November, and they abandoned Lake Champlain by early December. The British troops who surrendered at Saratoga, the so-called Convention Army, were supposed to be marched to Boston and shipped to Britain, with the stipulation that none of the men would take up arms in the Americas again. In order to make sure that this stipulation was enforced, Congress demanded a list of soldiers in the surrendered army. Burgoyne refused to provide such a list, so Congress decided not to honor the terms of the surrender. Instead, the British troops were kept in captivity as prisoners of war. While several officers were exchanged, much of the Convention Army, as it was called, marched south to Virginia. The men were imprisoned there for several years, though many of them escaped and subsequently settled in the United States after the war. As for Burgoyne, in the immediate wake of the surrender, he was a guest of Gates until he was exchanged for 1,000 American prisoners of war. After that, he returned to England, where he spent the next several years defending his actions before Parliament. In 1778, he was deprived of his rank, but it was restored to him in 1782 after a change of government. He was appointed a Privy Councillor and named the Commander-in-Chief of Forces in Ireland. He died on August 4, 1792. The Impact of the Campaign. The importance of Saratoga would be clear in hindsight, but at the time, things remained quite tenuous for the rebels. Despite Washington's efforts, the defeat at the Battle of Brandywine on September 11, 1777, meant the path to Philadelphia lay open for the British. After retreating from Brandywine, Washington rallied and regrouped to make another attempt to stall the British advance on Philadelphia. Washington's army continued to confront the British in Pennsylvania and New Jersey. But by late September, the British under Howe reached Germantown, Pennsylvania. Washington's army encamped in the White Marsh Valley, and Washington was determined to attack the British lines as soon as possible. After intelligence informed him that Howe had dispatched a considerable portion of his forces against American fortifications along the Delaware River, necessary for the British fleet to approach Philadelphia by water, Washington called a meeting of his general officers on September 28th to ask their opinion of an attack at Germantown. Anthony Wayne was one of a small group of officers who favored an immediate attack, while the other generals favored waiting until reinforcements arrived from the north. The usually careful and prudent Washington took the advice of Wayne and the other generals who advocated an immediate attack. Thus, on October 3rd, Washington moved his 11,000-man army towards the enemy camp at Germantown. Wayne, with General Sullivan, comprised the right wing of the American forces, and Washington ordered them to march down Skippack Road towards the Market House in Germantown, where the main body of the British forces were posted. Their advance was too rapid, and Wayne and Sullivan became trapped by the British forces when they were 2 miles ahead of the other American units. The Battle of Germantown was the last major engagement of the year, and in the wake of their victory at Germantown, the British occupied Philadelphia, forcing the Continental Congress to flee from the rebel capital to nearby York. By then, however, news of the Battle of Saratoga was spreading across the states and heading for Europe. Not surprisingly, the news of Burgoyne's surrender was a cause for jubilation across America. Congress adopted a resolution on November 1, 1777, declaring December 18, 1777, as a national day of thanksgiving and praise in recognition of the success at Saratoga. Washington issued orders for that day to be observed by the Continental Army, writing, "Being the day set apart by the Honorable Congress for public thanksgiving and praise, and duty calling us devoutly to express our grateful acknowledgments to God for the manifold blessings He has granted us, the General directs that the Army remain in its present quarters, and that the chaplains perform divine service with their several corps and brigades, and earnestly exhorts all officers and soldiers, whose absence is not indispensably necessary, to attend with reverence the solemnities of the day." Ironically, this singular American victory, technically won by one of Washington's most frequent critics, did not immediately affect the material welfare of the Continental Army, as attested to by Private Joseph Martin's account of how the Continental Army celebrated that first National Day of Thanksgiving. "Well, to add something extraordinary to our present stock of provisions, our country, ever mindful of its suffering army, opened her sympathizing heart so wide, upon this occasion, as to give us something to make the world stare, a half gill of rice and a tablespoonful of vinegar." The next day, Washington marched his army into winter quarters at Valley Forge. Benjamin Franklin had been sent by Congress to France in December 1776 to secure a critically needed alliance, and he was an ideal choice for enlightened France, which revered Franklin for his scientific accomplishments and his known reputation as a brilliant man. Franklin had also been a diplomat before the Revolution, spending several years in London on behalf of the colonies. However, the French refused to provide more than arms and money throughout 1777, until they learned in December 1777 about Saratoga and Burgoyne's surrender. With that news, French King Louis XVI entered into a formal military alliance with the United States, and in February 1778, France joined the war. Meanwhile, as he looked for a place to establish his winter camp, Washington came across a small community known as Valley Forge. Located 20 miles northwest of Philadelphia, it seemed like an ideal location. There was plenty of empty land around the village, in which his men could build shelters, and it was close enough to the British lines to keep an eye on their movements while being far enough away to keep them from attacking in force. His army had repeatedly faced a lack of discipline and chronic disorganization, and Congress began to consider replacing Washington as commander after the fall of Philadelphia. General Gates, who had received the lion's share of the credit for Saratoga by marginalizing Benedict Arnold's role in the victory when he submitted his report to the Congress, was floated as an alternative, and Washington was understandably devastated. Making matters worse, the winter was unusually harsh, leading to an estimated 2,000 or so deaths in camp from diseases. Governor Morris would later call the soldiers at Valley Forge a skeleton of an army, in a naked, starving condition, out of health, out of spirits. Despite the difficulties, it was at Valley Forge that Washington truly forged his army. He introduced a more rigorous training program for his troops, sponsored by Prussian General Frederick Wilhelm von Steuben, who had fought with Frederick the Great. Like the Marquis de Lafayette before him, von Steuben came to Washington's army by the recommendation of Benjamin Franklin, who hoped to use their appointments to curry political favor internationally. Despite speaking little English, von Steuben went about drafting a drill manual in French, and he personally presided over training drills and military parades. With the help of von Steuben, the Continental Army left Valley Forge in the spring of 1778, a more disciplined army than ever before, and the worst of their failures were behind them. France's entry into the war dramatically altered the strategic balance. The war became a global war, with much of Great Britain's possessions threatened. As a result, Great Britain was forced to spend more resources outside of the American theater. British strategy had to change to accommodate a global war. Great Britain had to protect its colonies in the West Indies, India, and even guard against a potential French invasion of Ireland. French participation also had an immediate effect on Great Britain's North American strategy. Prior to France's entry, Great Britain could move troops and supplies by sea with only minimal threat from American privateers. But France had a powerful navy that could threaten British troop movements and attack British-held towns from the sea. Thus, the British shifted their strategy to trying to subdue the South, which would lead to the fateful surrender at Yorktown in 1781. During the Revolution, Gates nearly leveraged the victory at Saratoga into successfully undermining Washington's position at the head of the Continental Army. But today, the battle is more closely associated with Benedict Arnold. American history books credit Arnold for the American success at Saratoga, and it cannot be understated how important Arnold's achievements were to the cause from 1775 to 1777. But given his subsequent treason, it would be short-sighted, if not downright imprudent, not to consider what his motivations were, even in serving there. Perhaps George Washington provided a succinct perspective when he said Benedict Arnold's left leg, which had been so badly wounded at Quebec and Saratoga, was the only patriotic part of his body. Washington said that if and when Arnold was captured, his leg should be cut off and buried with full honors, while the rest should hang. Benjamin Franklin himself wrote, "Judas sold only one man, Arnold 3 million." In the years following the Revolutionary War, it was discovered that Benedict Arnold wasn't the only American officer approached by the British to betray the cause. Several other disgruntled men were targeted, including John Sullivan, Daniel Morgan, Philip Schuyler, and Israel Putnam. However, they all rejected British overtures, which makes Arnold's decision appear that much more heinous. At the close of 1777, it could honestly be said that Benedict Arnold had been the colonists' greatest war hero, with his string of successes being longer and more crucial than anyone else in the army, including George Washington. It could even be argued that the Revolution may have been lost without his service at places like Ticonderoga, Lake Champlain, and Saratoga. And on top of it all, Arnold had spent a small fortune of his personal money financing his own actions, during which he was badly wounded many times and literally became a cripple in service to his country. After Saratoga, Arnold headed to the Continental Army at Valley Forge, where he was feted with applause and took one of the first USOs of allegiance. The following month, Washington placed Major General Arnold in command of Philadelphia, as French entry into the war had compelled the British to quit the rebel capital. Unaccustomed to power, Arnold began entering into business arrangements and capitalistic ventures even before reaching Philadelphia. On top of that, Arnold demonstrated his taste for luxury and extravagance, and in short order, there were plenty of local Philadelphians upset with him. How Arnold truly felt before he met the loyalist Peggy Shippen in Philadelphia is unclear, but it wound up being the most important connection Arnold made in the city. Shippen was from a well-to-do loyalist family, and while the British occupied the city the year before Peggy had made the acquaintance of John Andre, who was serving in General William Howe's command. Andre paid particular attention to Peggy. Peggy maintained contact with Andre even after the British left Philadelphia. After a brief courtship, Arnold married Peggy in April 1779, right around the time his court-martial was being resolved. It's widely believed by historians that Peggy helped induce Arnold's treason, and it was obviously her relationship with her dear friend John Andre, who had become General Henry Clinton's spy chief, that made Arnold's communications with the British possible. Given what ensued at West Point, it became impossible for Americans to fully acknowledge Arnold's contributions to the success of the Revolution. And for that reason, America has taken on a unique way of commemorating Arnold's military career. The most famous example can be found on the Bemis Heights battlefield. There, the inscription on the boot monument, which commemorates the spot where Arnold was injured during the battle, captures the manner in which the country has traditionally handled the process of acknowledging Arnold's extraordinarily important accomplishments for America, while always keeping in mind the fact that he is the nation's most infamous traitor. Erected 1887 by John Watts de Peyster. Major General SNY. In memory of the most brilliant soldier of the Continental Army, who is desperately wounded on this spot, the sally port of Burgoyne's Great Western Redoubt, 7th October 1777, winning for his countrymen the decisive battle of the American Revolution, and for himself the rank of Major General. Arnold received the same treatment in the Victory Monument at Saratoga, which also manages to acknowledge him without naming him. At that monument, the four greatest American heroes of the battle are commemorated with statues on one side of the monument. Gates, Schuyler, and Daniel Morgan all have statues, while one side remains empty, where Saratoga's greatest hero should have had a statue. Likewise, in John Trumbull's famous painting of Burgoyne's surrender, nearly two dozen rebel officers are depicted, but there is no sign of Arnold. It would literally take centuries for modern historians to offer a more nuanced perspective of Arnold's career and Saratoga's place in it. Historian James L. Stokesbury may have put it best when summing up Arnold's story. Ever since 1780, a host of writers from serious historians to respected novelists have attempted to rehabilitate Arnold without any convincing success. One point that needs to be made is that if honor was more touchy than now, so principles were more flexible. Private and public businesses were inextricably mixed. Patriotism, nepotism, and graft were accepted ways of managing affairs. Reasonably honest men might seek accommodation in a family quarrel and accept rewards for doing so. In other words, the line delineating treason was not very clearly drawn. None of this obviates the fact that Arnold crossed it. Arnold himself came to understand the ramifications of his decisions, including the action at Saratoga. In his final years, Arnold lived in England, where he would die on June 14, 1801, a miserable and broken man. A favorite American legend claimed that when Arnold was on his deathbed, he stated, "Let me die in this old uniform in which I fought my battles. May God forgive me for ever having put on another." The story is almost certainly apocryphal, but there is no question that Arnold ultimately lived to regret his decision, and he stated he wished the bullet at Bemis Heights had hit his chest, not his leg. This has been the Saratoga Campaign, the history and legacy of the Revolutionary War's turning points. Written by Charles River Editors. Narrated by Scott Clem. Copyright 2020 by Charles River Editors. Production copyright 2020 by Charles River Editors.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.